You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
We're calling for an end to this war.
Thousands of trade unionists assembled at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the Million Worker March on Sunday. So close to the upcoming presidential election, the event sought to shine a national spotlight on issues affecting America's workers, like the lack of health care insurance and massive job losses. In particular, many of the march's speakers called for an end to the U.S. war in Iraq. New York City Labor Against the War member Michael Letwin echoed the theme of bringing the workers' movement together with the anti-war movement.
The Million Worker March is part of a growing worldwide movement to end U.S. occupation of Iraq, to end imperial wars and occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine, the Philippines, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Haiti, to fight against the war at home that's being waged on workers, immigrants, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Larry Holmes, chairman of the International Action Center.
Who has more to lose from war and death and the money spent on war and the young people dying than working people? Right now in Iraq, the U.S.-led occupation forces have opened up a vicious new war. How many of you know about the bombing of Fallujah? It's being bombed as we speak. Untold numbers of people being killed. Iraqi and U.S. soldiers.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
In the last 4 years, we have seen the most openly destructive policies of government in the history of the United States. The policy is to enrich the rich and impoverish the poor. What's happened to wages? What's happened to jobs? And how many corporate executives are making more than $100 million a year?
The Million Worker March ended with a solidarity march to the Hotel Washington in support of contract negotiations for 3,800 district hotel workers and locked-out employees at hotels in San Francisco. Participants plan to hold the next administration accountable, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The U.S. trade deficit surged to $54 billion in August, ignited by a record foreign oil bill. It is the second highest level in history. Imports were also up, peaking at a record $150.1 billion. The trade deficit with China climbed to a record $18.1 billion as Americans crave more cell phones, toys, televisions, and DVD players. A coalition of textile groups have asked the Bush administration to limit the import of textiles from China in an attempt to boost textile jobs in the United States.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So, Jasper, how was your year?
Excellent. This administration gives the best returns ever.
Do tell.
Well, the money I paid to a lobbying firm in Washington brought in over $50 million in overseas contracts.
Oh, yes, lobbying pays.
Are you still into commodities, Max?
No, I'm funding politicians. My campaign contributions got me over $100 million worth of regulation waivers.
Well done, Max.
Today's wisest investments are in politics. Where are you throwing your money?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
After a recent congressional vote on the Freedom to Read Protection Act, one angry member said, "You win some, and some get stolen." He was a Republican, defying George W., John Ashcroft, and his own party's top leadership in Congress, all of whom lobbied furiously to defeat this act, which sought to ensure one of our most basic American liberties, the right to keep government snoops and bullies from secretly spying on the reading habits of perfectly innocent citizens. What could be more mom and apple pie than that? Bush, Ashcroft, and gang, however, had undermined this fundamental freedom with a nasty provision they tucked into their infamous liberty-busting USA Patriot Act in 2001. It allows federal agents to get a secret order from a secret court to walk into any public library or bookstore and demand the records of any and all patrons without showing anyone, even the court, any evidence that the people being investigated are involved in any criminal activity whatsoever. It's jackbooted autocratic power like this that led to the American Revolution. And just as in 1776, today's librarians, bookstore owners, writers, and freedom-loving people of all political stripes have risen up against the Bushites' authoritarian, un-American intrusion into our privacy. This grassroots uprising led to the Freedom to Read Act, which would have halted the intrusion. The good news is that the act passed. The sad news is that the GOP hierarchy then cheated. They held the vote open beyond the time allowed by the rules, taking an extra 23 minutes while the leaders broke the arms of 9 Republicans, forcing them to switch votes, thus defeating the act. In other words, the Bushites stole it, and they also stole an important piece of our liberties. This is Jim Hightower saying, but we've only begun to fight this insult to our democracy. To join the uprising, call the American Library Association, 800-545-2433.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. Score power at Equifax.com.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, happy Monday. 15 days to regime change. Here it is, the 18th of October. We're creeping up on November 2nd. Closer and closer. When are they going to trot out Osama? What is going to be the October surprise? Some folks speculating now that the October surprise itself is actually the Sinclair broadcast thing. I don't know. This absolutely amazing article that I read. And was it Harper's or the Atlantic Monthly? On the airplane last Thursday on my way to California, or it must have been Wednesday night, and about how Karl Rove always goes for these close elections because then he can manipulate the system, manipulate public thinking, and end up stealing the election as he did in 2000, and it's just chilling. Absolutely chilling. The idea that it's not about democracy, it's not about the will of the people, it's not about what's best for the nation, it's about our side wins. And, I, with some pride, I suppose, I say that, I hold up as a value for this program that the primary goal of my program, of the Tom Hartman program, is not to be partisan. You know, we talk about the radical middle, and it's because I think that there are a lot of Americans who have become radicalized by excesses on both the left and the right, but particularly on the right over the last few years. They want their country back. We've seen, not in the United States so much, but certainly in the Soviet Union, what is sometimes referred to as the left. Some argue it's actually the extreme right. You know that there's no difference. Stalin and Hitler were different in rhetoric, but not in other arenas. And that's splitting hairs, but. But there are those who argue that, we've seen the extreme left where the state owns the means of production and the means of distribution, what Karl Marx suggested in Das Kapital and Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. And it didn't work. Now, there are those who still defend that system and say, well, it didn't work because Stalin was a paranoid, I mean, literally, as in psychosis, paranoid, who created a dictatorship rather than a communist state. But I still think in any community fewer than 150 people, it won't work. And the reason why is any kind of central control. Well, let me back up just a little bit. On the right, you see this concern about on the left central control by the state. On the left, you see concern about central control by corporations, by the wealthy, by the powerful few, by the elite. And I think these are both legitimate concerns. And the reason, very simply, and we're going to, in more depth, get into this in the second hour of the program today, because we're going to have on Sam Kasman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who is one of these, it's an organization largely funded by corporations and super wealthy, super conservative individuals, and putting forth the line that, yeah, we need less regulation, right? Let's get the government out of the lives of the corporations so the corporations can do what they want. And well, we'll get into that then. But what you find is that in communities of 150 people or fewer, which oddly is virtually how all tribal communities are, they basically, once they reach 150 people, they split. Even the early Mormon communities, Brigham Young had this thing about when a community reached more than 150 people, it had to split in the early days. When there are fewer than 150 people, then communalism, or all for one and one for all, tribalism, the sense of we're all in this absolutely together, group decision making, pure democracy works very, very well. And once you get beyond 150 people, it doesn't seem to work. And some fascinating research done over the last 15 years, mostly in England, about the size of brains and communities. And what they did was they looked at the size of animal brains and the size of the community, social animals, and the size of the communities that they formed. And they found that, if the brain was 100 cc's, then you had nine animals in the typical community. If it was 200 cc's, you went up to 15 animals, whatever. I don't have the numbers right here in front of me. But the larger the brain, the larger the community. And they concluded, after looking at all these different kinds of animals and their fixed community sizes, and they know that once the community, the animal community, reaches that certain threshold, then as new are born, if they're not replacing those who have died, they get thrown out of the community and they have to go off and start their own community or join another one, that it had to do with the number of relationships that you can maintain, which is a function of the size of your brain. How many people can you really truly know? And this is a function of the size of the physical size of the brain and, and the capacity that's associated with that. And so they projected, in the absence of any empirical data, they projected hypothetically how many people, what would be the optimal number of people in a community of humans? What's the maximum number of human beings that a person can know? And just taking brain size and just drawing a graph and looking at all these different animals and pointing them on a XY axis and just drawing the line out to the 1,500 cc brain size of humans, they said, okay, if this is true of lemurs and chimpanzees and this and this and this and this and this, then, dog packs, whatever, then at 150 cc brain, the community size should be 150 people. And then they started looking at that magic number, and they found it everywhere. All through human history, community sizes of 150 people and fewer. So, there are these utopians on the communist side, to use that word in its sort of original meaning, who say, well, we can't. It is possible for everybody to live together and to from each according to his capability, to each according to his needs, and all that sort of thing. But not in a community greater than 150 people. This is why communism works on a kibbutz in Israel, but not in a nation of, more than 50 million people like Russia, or I think it was well over 100 million, actually. The overall Soviet Union, I don't remember the population, is substantial, probably a couple hundred million. And why we, the people, then get together and say, because we don't know everybody who is supplying us with our food like you would in a small community, who is supplying us with our medication or even being our doctors, who is supplying us with health services, who is making sure that our water is safe, who is making sure that the products that are manufactured don't kill us, because we don't know everybody and we can't bring social pressure to bear on them, then we have to have regulations. We simply must. Our communities are larger than 150 people. So we're going to get into this in some depth in the next hour. This is, by the way, I think the same thing with Sinclair and this whole debate, really, the whole argument about the size of media corporations. And frankly, I think it's true not just of media corporations, it's true of all corporations, that the founders were very clear that a corporation can only be founded by the states. The word corporation does not exist in the Constitution. It's why there was such an argument about and why they ultimately turned down Thomas Jefferson's suggestion that there be a ban on corporate monopolies, on commercial monopolies, written right into the Constitution as part of the Bill of Rights. And Madison's response to Jefferson was, you know, we don't need that because every state already has that. Plus, it's not the business of the federal government to get into regulating corporate behavior because corporate behavior is regulated at the state level. And the reason it's regulated at the state level is because at the state level, they're close to those corporations. They're right on the ground. Those are the people. They live next door. And so if a corporation is misbehaving, the people from the community can show up at the front door of the owners of the corporation, the stockholders of the corporation, the CEO of the corporation, and knock on their door and say, you know, we need to have a talk. And that's how it was for the first 100 years in the United States. But no more. We now have empires and kingdoms within the United States. We call them corporations, multinational corporations. Again, as I've said a million times, well, certainly hundreds of times on this program, I am not only not opposed to the corporate form, I am in favor of it. I incorporated for this program. I mean, I have run numerous corporations. I'm the chairman of the board of two nonprofit corporations, a private school for ADHD kids and a community for abused kids in New Hampshire. I'm on the board of a program for abused kids in Australia. I helped set up a hospital in Africa. It's incorporated in Uganda during the war with Idi Amin. I'm not opposed to corporations. I started an ad agency in Atlanta. We started a travel agency in Atlanta. I used to own an herbal tea company. I've been in the business world. I'm all in favor of corporations. The problem is when the corporation becomes so large and starts doing business not only in multiple states but multiple nations and acquires a level of wealth that all of its senior management can insulate themselves from the community at large so they're no longer responsive to social pressure, then we must have legal pressure. Very simple. Very simple. So I want you to keep those concepts in mind in the second hour as we get Sam Katzman on, who's going to try and tell us that all regulation is bad. If we just let the corporations free, they would do everything wonderfully, and on it goes. So the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, several people have forwarded this to me from the Internet. I have not. Louise spent about an hour this morning trying to track the original source of it. Haven't been able to find it. Apparently it was in one of the Phoenix newspapers, although it may be apocryphal. I don't know. But it's a great story. I have to share it with you. It probably is apocryphal. At the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport yesterday, an individual later discovered to be a public school teacher was arrested trying to board a flight while in possession of a ruler, a protractor, a set square, a slide rule, and a calculator. At a morning press conference, Attorney General John Ashcroft said he believes the man is a member of the notorious Al-Jibra movement. He is being charged by the FBI with carrying weapons of math instruction. Al-Jibra, also known as algebra, is a fearsome cult, Ashcroft said. They desire average solutions by means and extremes, and sometimes go off on tangents in search of absolute value. They use secret code names like X and Y and refer to themselves as unknowns. But we have determined they belong to a common denominator of the axis of medieval, with coordinates in every country. As the Greek philanderer Isosceles used to say, there are three sides to every triangle. And a quote from John Ashcroft. When asked to comment on the arrest, President Bush said, if God had wanted us to have better weapons of math instruction, he would have given us more fingers and more toes. So, if you know the author of that, I'd love to give credit. I thought at first it was Andy Borowitz, but it turns out it wasn't. Anyhow, Al Zakari Why are we at war in Iraq? I think increasingly we are seeing the evidence of the reason why we're at war in Iraq. And I want to share that with you, the neocon vision of this libertarian new world order. And Zarqawi is helping us figure it out. It's the Tom Hartman Program, Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. In vacuums, bagless is a dirty word. In fact, they're filthy. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums. My newest hypoallergenic 8-pound Orrick XL uses triple-walled disposable filter bags. Try my new vacuum free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Orrick, the clean alternative to bagless vacuum.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza man.
Hey, you're not the pizza man. You're the cable guy again.
Price patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice cream man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a 4-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Acid rain is not a problem, said a businessman. But all the fish are belly up and floating round. And there's nothing growing from the ground. Just ask Farmer Brown.
And welcome. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. And El-Zarqawi, what's his name? Abu Musab El-Zarqawi has now, of course, the big news, you know, the stuff that's in all the newspapers and the media and everything over the weekend, that he has declared his allegiance with Al-Qaeda. So, of course, Bush is going to be, and in fact already is, going out to the great unwashed, the mass of the American people. No, I don't mean that in a derisive fashion. It's this is the way they refer to them within the Bush administration. It's like John Adams used to refer to us as the rabble. And starts saying, well, yeah, Al-Qaeda is in Iraq, and we have to attack them, and blah-de-blah, and it's going to cause a lot of those people who have only been sort of paying attention, a lot of those folks who they watch sports instead of news kind of thing. And I'm not trashing people who watch sports. I spent part of yesterday afternoon watching a football game, but stuck in an airport, I might add. But nonetheless, the point is that they're going to be going into this rant now about Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, El-Zarqawi, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it's going to reprogram people's minds and get them thinking, oh, yeah, Al-Qaeda, Iraq, Al-Qaeda, attack the towers. We must be in Iraq. Stop Al-Qaeda. Right, there's a certain logic to that. I mean, Joseph Goebbels, the father of modern propaganda, said it doesn't matter if something's true or not. I'm paraphrasing here. He said it doesn't matter if something's true or not. If you repeat it often enough, people will come to believe it is. The concept referred to as the big lie. Well, now we have created Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it goes on now. Jordanian militant, Zarqawi actually isn't Iraqi, he's Jordanian. Abu Musab El-Zarqawi has threatened to attack foreign trucks carrying imports of refined oil products into Iraq. This from the Iraqi oil ministry this weekend. Apparently a pamphlet has been published and is floating around Iraq. It says the Tawhid and Jihad has already killed a number of drivers. The Turks you hear are kidnapped, mostly drive fuel trucks. Said the official who asked not to be named. The two most recent beheadings by Zarqawi were Iraqis. What was their crime? They were driving foreign fuel trucks. Now, one of the complaints that we've had from our soldiers, we had actually on this program about 4 months ago, we had on one occasion a soldier, an ex-soldier, somebody who was back and discharged, and because that's the only circumstances under which they're willing to speak out. And on another occasion, the mother of a soldier saying that, and there have been numerous reports about this in the press. In fact, I shared a really good, I believe it was a Newsweek story with you about this, about that time, saying that originally Halliburton had hired one of these private contractors, private defense companies, to guard the trucks because Halliburton delivers gasoline. Delivers fuel all over Iraq. You know, that's part of that $7 billion no-bid contract. In fact, that was part of one of the big scandals was that gasoline in Iraq costs 5 cents a gallon, 5 to 10 cents a gallon. That's a retail at the pump. Yeah, seriously. You want to fill your tank in Iraq, costs you $1.10. It's, 5 to 10 cents a gallon. But we buy that gasoline from refineries in Kuwait at anywhere from 70 to 80 cents a gallon. Well, somehow Halliburton was billing us $1.50, $1.80, $1.90 a gallon. So that made a big scandal. But anyhow, a lot of soldiers don't want to be the guys who are providing security to Halliburton's trucks. And there's this revolt going on. And what this is doing, in large part, in my opinion, is it is revealing the neocon vision, their attempts to reorder Iraq. I'll share more with you about that right after this break.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Talk about unsanitary. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums or wear a dust mask. Imagine vacuuming your house wearing a dust mask. Friends, try my hypoallergenic 8-pound Orrick XL free for 30 days. It's 99.99% dust-free. Call 1-800-989-4200.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Thousands of trade unionists assembled at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the Million Worker March on Sunday. So close to the upcoming presidential election, the event sought to shine a national spotlight on issues affecting America's workers, like the lack of health care insurance and massive job losses. In particular, many of the march's speakers called for an end to the U.S. war in Iraq. New York City Labor Against the War member Michael Letwin echoed the theme of bringing the workers' movement together with the anti-war movement.
The Million Worker March is part of a growing worldwide movement to end U.S. occupation of Iraq, to end imperial wars and occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine, the Philippines, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Haiti, to fight against the war at home that's being waged on workers, immigrants, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Larry Holmes, chairman of the International Action Center.
Who has more to lose from war and death and the money spent on war and the young people dying than working people? Right now in Iraq, the U.S.-led occupation forces have opened up a vicious new war. How many of you know about the bombing of Fallujah? It's being bombed as we speak. Untold numbers of people being killed. Iraqi and U.S. soldiers.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
In the last 4 years, we have seen the most openly destructive policies of government in the history of the United States. The policy is to enrich the rich and impoverish the poor. What's happened to wages? What's happened to jobs? And how many corporate executives are making more than $100 million a year?
The Million Worker March ended with the Solidarity March to the Hotel Washington in support of contract negotiations for 3,800 district hotel workers and locked-out employees at hotels in San Francisco. Participants plan to hold the next administration accountable, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The U.S. trade deficit surged to $54 billion in August, ignited by a record foreign oil bill. It is the second highest level in history. Imports were also up, peaking at a record $150.1 billion. The trade deficit with China climbed to a record $18.1 billion as Americans crave more cell phones, toys, televisions, and DVD players. A coalition of textile groups have asked the Bush administration to limit the import of textiles from China in an attempt to boost textile jobs in the United States.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Take me for you stole my heart and now you're back for more.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman here. Yeah, George, you told us you were a compassionate conservative. No. 27 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website if you want to drop into our message board or drop into a live chat, which is now full up. There's still room for people to drop in, but a lot of folks in our chat room visiting. Trish has made it back, for those of you who are Trish fans. And Rama's here answering the phones and engineering our program. We're having a great day. By the way, just as an FYI for the week, on Wednesday, the first hour of our program, Rama's going to be filling in for me. We've got a camera crew coming down for a PBS, Public Broadcasting, special on global warming that they're putting together. It's already in release in Canada. They're doing a U.S. version of it. It's being partly funded by Leonardo DiCaprio. And the camera crew is coming down on Wednesday to shoot me, and we're going to be doing that all morning. I'm going to do an hour of the show, the first hour, I'm sorry. And then the second and third hour of the program, Rama's going to fill in, and because we're going to go off and do some more ranting on camera. And then on Friday, I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. at the Heritage Foundation, and along with Alan Colmes, from noon to 3, I'm going to be debating four conservative talk show hosts. It'll be filmed by C-SPAN, but unfortunately we can't pick it up as a feed. So unfortunately for me, fortunate for you because you get to hear Rama Schneider again. He'll be filling in for us all 3 hours on Friday. So that's what's up our week. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Wanting to get in order 39 here. I think this is the crux of the whole thing. But first, let's take a call from Jake, a trucker on the road, I assume listening on the Sirius satellite radio system.
That's right.
Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. I was just telling the other gentleman, I'm a registered Republican, and I didn't vote for Bush last time, and he's got me scared of this time.
Yeah,
I always vote absentee because I'm not going to lose it, and I've already cast my ballot for the Democrat. My question was, you just alluded to the fact that Zarqawi is on the Internet now seeing how he's going to join Osama bin Laden.
Right.
Everybody else I've heard and read about are saying the same thing because it's on the Internet.
Yeah.
Why are we taking this as a gospel? Because it's on the Internet, could that not be a plant?
It could easily be. And whether it was planted by Karl Rove or whether it was planted by bin Laden or whether it was planted by just some, 15-year-old kid in Switzerland who thought it would
right.
be fun, it's entirely possible. But the unfortunate reality, the reason I think so many people are taking it so seriously, is that it is so obvious, so very painfully obvious, that by invading Iraq with no plan to really and truly secure the nation and provide for the security of the Iraqi people, we protected the oil ministry and nothing else. And
right.
and the looting did not just extend to the National Museum. The looting now we find extended to the facilities where they had the machines to actually make nuclear weapons, which have now been carted off and taken out of the country intact. And you've got the average Iraqi now. Very upset. We have gone from being, at least theoretically, and perhaps for a short time, the solution to being the problem. And I think that this is probably a strategic move on Zakari's part. He's feeling the noose tightening if he is hiding out in Fallujah or wherever he is. I mean, basically an insurgency, just like with the American Revolution, an insurgency can't happen if the majority of the people don't at least passively support it. All it takes
This is true. I won't keep you very long, but whenever Bush invaded Pakistan, I was behind him 100%. After the towers, I wanted to bomb somebody.
You mean Afghanistan?
Right.
Yeah.
But whenever he left there and went to Iraq, then he lost me entirely. I don't think that was necessary at all.
Yeah, he lost the whole world. I mean, literally.
Unfortunately, that's the problem.
Yeah. I agree with you. Thanks, Jake, for the call. I appreciate it. It was well said. And I think that the other possibility is that Zarqawi, feeling the noose tightening, is reaching out to the larger force, to the other superpower, that being a billion Muslims. And there's this battle going on right now in Islam, just like there's a battle in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party for the heart and soul of Islam. The battle in the Republican Party, of course, is between the classic Republicans like you, Jake, who historically have viewed the party as the party of moderation, as the party of balanced budgets, as the party of environmental conservation, the whole what's a conservative? It ain't that anymore. It ain't that. It's been hijacked by radical extremists. George Bush being at the front of the lead, or maybe Dick Cheney being at the front of the lead, and George Bush being his. Some would say puppet, others would say co-conspirator. I think the latter is a little more charitable. But I'm willing to believe that Zarqawi would align himself even unilaterally. I mean, you know, Bin Laden may not want him, but Zarqawi needs all the help he can get, all the friends he can get. And that's going to bring this about. But here's really the bottom line. I mean, this, you know, George Bush Sr. kept talking about the New World Order. Now, there's one particular irony here. The two big phrases that Hitler used, one of the two big phrases that Hitler used when he was creating his Nazis. I mean, Hitler was a utopianist, just like the neocons are. Obviously, there's huge differences, all kinds of differences. But this is what happens when utopian ideologies trump. And one of Hitler's phrases was the New World Order. The other big phrase that these were things that he introduced into the lexicon, into the language of the German people that didn't exist there before. The other was the word homeland. The word homeland pretty much did not exist. You know, it was used in Germany, but it was used mostly by the Zionist movement, by Jews in the Zionist movement. And it was not, the word homeland was not something that was, the German government, it was referred to sometimes as the fatherland. But Hitler had looked very carefully at the Zionist movement. I mean, these guys were obsessed with the Jews, and they were studying the Zionist movement. They said, and the Zionists were saying, we need a homeland. And a homeland implies some kind of collective racial heritage. It's like, my mother in the 60s, her family in the 1600s came over to the United States from England and Wales. So on my mother's side of the family, that's their homeland. My father's family came to this country around the time of World War I from Norway. And so, I'm half Norwegian. So that's also partly my homeland. Your homeland is like, where your roots are. And Hitler did this whole huge thing of blood and soil. And I think most of us are old enough to remember that before October of 2001, when the word Meisters got a hold of this, we didn't use the word homeland to describe the United States. We talked about domestic policy. We talked about the nation, the national interests, the United States of America. Nobody ever used the word homeland because we are not a biological and genetic homeland. We are not, there is not, racial homogeneity here in the United States. The white power movement used the word homeland. The American Nazi Party used the word homeland. And used as an excuse to say, and therefore they argued that we should get rid of all the blacks, all the Jews, all the Hispanics, blah de blah de blah, right? This was the white supremacist movement was using the word homeland. And all of a sudden, after 9/11, this word popped up. And I just find it so ironic that Bush Sr. Brought one of Hitler's favorite phrases, the New World Order, into being. And Bush Jr. brought Hitler's second famous phrase. And Hitler's third most famous phrase, I'm telling you this, I literally know a bunch of old Nazis. I lived in Germany for a year. I know people in their 80s and 90s who were fervent Nazis back in those days. And not only that, I've read the histories and things. Here's, for example, Rudolf Hess. The word homeland in German is Heimat. Heimat means home. Heimat. And but just listen for the word Heimat. And in this is 1934, in the Nuremberg rallies, Rudolf Hess introducing Adolf Hitler, and for the first time, very calculatedly, introducing the word homeland into the lexicon, which the Nazis then used very, very carefully.
Dank Ihrer Führung.
Thanks to our Führer.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen. Heimat.
Let's start that again. Thanks to our Führer. Thanks to our Führer, Germany is now arising again. The homeland is once again.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen.
Here it comes.
Heimat zu sein.
And then he repeats it.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt. Alle Führer! Sieg!
Heimat zu sein für alles Deutsche in der Welt, for all the Germans in the world. We will now create the homeland. And this is a truly scary mentality. Truly scary mentality. And now, here's this vision of the neocons, is that they would turn Iraq into the utopian state. They would do in Iraq what they want to do in the United States. Flat tax of 15%, borders absolutely open. Anybody can import any product free of taxes. And multinational corporations can own everything and don't have to leave any profits within the company. Labor unions are declared illegal, and if you try to unionize, you are put in prison. These are the rules that we imposed. Now, the last one, of course, was under Saddam. We kept it. These are the rules that we've imposed on the Iraqi people. And I'm here to tell you that the Iraqi people are as upset about these rules that are enriching multinational corporations and not giving money to local Iraqi entrepreneurs and businesses as they are anything else. And if we were simply to say we're going to undo the neocon constitution that we imposed on the Iraqi people, particularly our Order 39, which decreed that foreign firms can retain 100% ownership in Iraqi banks, Iraqi mines, Iraqi families, and they can take 100% of their profits out of Iraq. The conservative dream. What they want to do to this country, they have done to Iraq, and it is destroying the country. If we were simply to roll those things back and say, you guys can have rules like every other country in the world that actually protect your domestic economy. I mean, yes, we're undoing them here in America, and we're ripping apart our middle class, and the CEO class is getting wealthier by the day. But, you know, we'll let you have the same kind of rules that Japan has, for example. That if you want to do business, you have to have a local partner. If you're going to make profits, you have to keep them in the country and pay taxes on them. But the cons, you know, they're not going to go for that. Let's take a few calls. NATO from Hood River, Oregon is on the line. Our number, by the way, 1-866-889-8894. Natano, I'm sorry, I mispronounced your name. Hey, Natano.
No problem. Great show. Usually agree with just about everything you say, but it's interesting you mentioned the correlation between the Nazis and these guys, because my dad's uncle actually defended a guy that was accused of burning down the Reichstag. And
Marius von der Lubbe. Marius von der Lubbe, February 23rd, 1930, what, 32,
33? Yeah, 33, I think it was.
Yeah, 33.
He defended him because his wife was looking for someone to defend him, and everyone was getting a little bit scared, and so my dad's uncle took it on and wound up in a Gestapo prison cell, the same cell a year later.
Yeah,
he wrote a book about it.
Oh, interesting.
And it talks about how they just dismantled the entire German Constitution. And
they did it in a matter of months. They did it with the Enabling Acts, and they actually had to put sunset provisions into those things to get them through Parliament, just like with the Patriot Act.
Yeah, they're just taking every page out of this book.
We are, and that's what got me started on this whole rant, is that these guys are using the big lie technique of Goebbels. And so, you know, look at all these parallels. I mean, it's really, truly scary.
Yeah, but
it's not scary, I don't think, because, the Nazis are coming. It's scary because this is how democracy gets usurped.
But right, as if the human gene pool is improving over time. I mean, with currency introduced into the human gene pool, I think we're going the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know, because now the weaker genes, I mean, if you want to talk about eugenics, the sleaze of the society rise to the top because they don't have any problem with lying or unethical behavior.
Yeah, let's not go down that road. I know that's not what you called about. Natana, what your point about the USSR?
Yeah, I think Khrushchev said, you will become like us, and he didn't say we will bury you. He said we will be there at your funeral.
That's right.
There's a closer translation to what he said.
He actually said that the Soviet state would be at the funeral of capitalism.
Yeah, and when you said that the far left was an example of the Soviet system in Russia, I think what we're doing is becoming like that, but I don't think it's a left-wing thing. I think it's a right-wing thing because what they had was state capitalism. We have is we're moving towards state capitalism, but it's a very fascist form of it, and it's
yeah. That was why I said, you know, I'm just using shorthand terms, the phrases that most people understand, and we could get into a long discussion of this, which I guess we're doing. But you know, I agree with you. And you know, Mussolini defined fascism as the merger of state and corporate interests, and they just took the word corporate out of the equation in the Soviet Union. You know, we're doing the same thing here, and it's a dangerous trend. Good point, Natano. Thanks for the call, and great thanks for hearing, listening to us there in Hood River, Oregon. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour. Truth and common sense. Common sense. What a rare commodity on the radio in broadcasting.
Bonjour. My name is Veronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir. Billionaires
for more. Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Critics say that when we consolidate the media into fewer and fewer hands, it threatens diversity. Nothing could be further from the truth. Every demographic has different consuming habits. With 500 channels, we'll have one shopping network for Elvis memorabilia and another for the dogs playing poker crowd. Something for everyone. In this spirit, we billionaires are buying up the airwaves. If you're on a road trip from Kennebunkport to Crawford, you can tune in to Rush the whole trip down. Just think, the same country and soft rock stations everywhere you go. And what we leave off the dial, you're better off without, really. Aren't you glad someone's protecting you from polka music? You're welcome. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here comes the billionaire!
We the people now face a fundamental choice. Take back our government or do nothing and become the victims of tyranny and empire.
That is the message in a revealing new book by Tom Hartman, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People takes a hard look at America's past, present, and future. You'll find out that the Patriot Act is not unique. In 1798, President John Adams pushed the Alien and Sedition Acts through a Federalist Congress, enabling him to have his unpatriotic critics arrested and imprisoned, putting numerous opposition newspapers out of business. While a bit more subtle, Hartman says, this administration is likewise attempting to suppress any criticism, to eradicate any opposition. Progressive talk show host Janine Garofalo says, read this book for a jolt of illumination. We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. As the presidential election looms closer, Americans' prosperity has become a central campaign issue, and a new report by the Working Poor Families Project throws new light on a highly charged debate. More than one quarter of all U.S. workers are paid poverty wages, and 20 million children live in families that don't earn enough to meet basic needs, according to a shocking new report entitled Working Hard, Falling Short. Brandon Roberts is co-author of the publication.
9.2 million working families are low income. These are families that are struggling to make ends meet and to advance to the middle class.
Robert says there's a huge and growing disparity between America's low-income service labor force and businesses' demand for highly skilled workers. He says there needs to be a coordinated effort between states and the federal government on programs that help low-wage workers.
Across the country, we have a very uneven commitment from state to state in how we assist low-income, hard-working families to get ahead and to stay ahead. And, of course, our key recommendation is engender a national discussion and examination of how we can better utilize our resources and our public systems.
Robert suggests a minimum wage hike as a simple measure that could be taken to immediately lift some of the financial burden off the backs of working families.
One third of these low-income working families have a parent without a high school degree. If you take a typical family of four with two working adults, if both of those workers were employed full-time year-round and earned the minimum wage, together their salary is going to equal $21,424. That's far short of what it takes for a family to be economically self-sufficient.
With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Randy from Salt Lake City on the line. Hey, Randy, welcome to the program.
How are you, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Randy?
I have a question. Not just you, but I come from the conservative viewpoint, and I've listened for months about you and other liberals really coming down on George Bush because he's in a war, wrong place, wrong time. There are no weapons of mass destruction. But just moments ago, still I hear you discuss about the problems of having tools for weapons of mass destruction stolen out of Iraq. And I'm curious, how come no one has at least acknowledged the fact that, okay, we were wrong, there were tools for the manufacturing of weapons of mass destruction?
I don't think anybody was ever saying that there weren't. I mean, there's a huge step from having a high-precision lathe to having a bomb. And the tool, and these were dual-use tools, by the way. They were things that could be used to manufacture precision electronics. They could be used to manufacture all kinds of things. They could also be used to manufacture bombs. And the IAEA back in 1991 went in and identified these buildings, put tags on every single one of these machines, rendered them unusable by, you know, like tying them up, right? You know, stringing, you know, running cords and cables and things through them, locked in ways that they could be made useful again. But these were not weapons of mass destruction. These were tools that could be used to make weapons of mass destruction. And to have a program to make weapons of mass, you know, Bush is right when he says that they had the capacity to begin a program to make weapons of mass destruction. But that's three steps. That's three steps. Saying somebody has got a lathe is not worth killing over 1,000 American soldiers and over 30,000 Iraqis. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't think we're talking about the death toll simply because of lathes that were rendered useless. The fact of the matter is the campaign against Bush's actions were that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
And there were.
And I've been listening, and just a short while ago, you still made a reference to weapons of mass destruction. I mean, we know that the tools are gone. The
well,
entire
if I, Randy, gone. Randy, if I said that, I apologize. I misspoke. There were no tools. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There still aren't. What are missing are the tools, as you correctly assert, are the tools, you know, specifically high precision lathes, laser guided lathes, that could be used to manufacture the stuff that could become weapons of mass destruction. Absolutely right. Maybe we're splitting hairs here, I'm not sure. But thanks for the point. Well made. I appreciate the call. And, you know, particularly anybody who's going to disagree with me, I'll always put you at the front of the line. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
We're calling for an end to this war.
Thousands of trade unionists assembled at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the Million Worker March on Sunday. So close to the upcoming presidential election, the event sought to shine a national spotlight on issues affecting America's workers, like the lack of health care insurance and massive job losses. In particular, many of the march's speakers called for an end to the U.S. war in Iraq. New York City Labor Against the War member Michael Letwin echoed the theme of bringing the workers' movement together with the anti-war movement.
The Million Worker March is part of a growing worldwide movement to end U.S. occupation of Iraq, to end imperial wars and occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine, the Philippines, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Haiti, to fight against the war at home that's being waged on workers, immigrants, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Larry Holmes, chairman of the International Action Center.
Who has more to lose from war and death and the money spent on war and the young people dying than working people? Right now in Iraq, the U.S.-led occupation forces have opened up a vicious new war. How many of you know about the bombing of Fallujah? It's being bombed as we speak. Untold numbers of people being killed. Iraqi and U.S. soldiers.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
In the last 4 years, we have seen the most openly destructive policies of government in the history of the United States. The policy is to enrich the rich and impoverish the poor. What's happened to wages? What's happened to jobs? And how many corporate executives are making more than $100 million a year?
The Million Worker March ended with a solidarity march to the Hotel Washington in support of contract negotiations for 3,800 district hotel workers and locked-out employees at hotels in San Francisco. Participants plan to hold the next administration accountable, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The U.S. trade deficit surged to $54 billion in August, ignited by a record foreign oil bill. It is the second highest level in history. Imports were also up, peaking at a record $150.1 billion. The trade deficit with China climbed to a record $18.1 billion as Americans crave more cell phones, toys, televisions, and DVD players. A coalition of textile groups have asked the Bush administration to limit the import of textiles from China in an attempt to boost textile jobs in the United States.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So, Jasper, how was your year?
Excellent. This administration gives the best returns ever.
Do tell.
Well, the money I paid to a lobbying firm in Washington brought in over $50 million in overseas contracts.
Oh, yes, lobbying pays.
Are you still into commodities, Max?
No, I'm funding politicians. My campaign contributions got me over $100 million worth of regulation waivers.
Well done, Max.
Today's wisest investments are in politics. Where are you throwing your money?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Here's a new political slogan with some integrity and democratic gravitas to it. Let's run government like a government. This is, of course, the opposite of the tired, old, tried, and failed slogan that politicians of both parties have been pushing for years. We'll run government like a business. The Clintonites used this in the 90s with their Reinventing Government campaign, declaring that government agencies should become efficient business operations and treat people as customers. Oh? Efficient like what? The mammoth insurance company bureaucracies, or maybe the military contractors who waste and defraud us of billions of our tax dollars? And do they mean customer treatment like we get from don't-give-a-damn banks and telephone companies? Today, we have a fully corporatized White House run by former CEOs, including Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and company. They're literally running government through such standard corporate practices as operating in secret, twisting tax laws to benefit the elite, opposing public disclosure and right-to-know laws, shutting out dissenters and dissing dissent itself, rigging the regulatory rules for corporate gain, stomping on labor, running roughshod over the environment, disempowering consumers, and using advertising gimmicks to hide their deceits. It's time to get real. Government is not a business, and we are not customers. We're citizens. Far from being passive consumers of governmental policies, we're the sovereign powers who can make or unmake those policies. Corporations, by their very nature, are exclusive private empires that exist to serve the bottom line of the wealthiest investors, including the CEOs. Everyone and everything else be damned. That's no model for a democracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, America's founders knew that corporate power was anathema to the public interest and to the democratic will of the people. So they created a framework to run government like a government. It's time to put those democratic principles into action again.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on terrestrial radio stations in California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org. Our chat room live, go to tomhartman.com and click on that. In fact, we have listeners from even as far away as Tokyo in there hanging out today. Our number, 1-866-889-8894. What are the consequences of government regulation? This is a fascinating and really a multifaceted discussion. Let's get into this with Sam Kasman, who's the general counsel to the Competitive Enterprise Institute and head of the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Death by Regulation project. Sam, we should probably start out by saying that you guys are basically supported by large corporations and very conservative foundations, right?
And quite a few individuals, and no government whatsoever.
Right. Okay. And your point of view tends to be more on the side of multinational corporations than on the side of folks who think the government should regulate them.
Well, I mean, it's on the side of markets, which quite often means we're in favor of deregulation on a whole host of issues.
But how do markets get created?
They get created by people consenting to trade with other people.
Right.
And quite often that takes the form of companies, which very often takes the form of corporations. And if those companies are good enough, they tend to become multinational corporations. So Sometimes.
But the substrate.
Corporations get big and successful not by being good at what they do, but being good at bribing other folks.
Sure, sure. But the substrate upon which it's all resting is a currency, a stable currency system, a stable court system. This is government, right? A stable set of rules, the laws that say, you know, here's what companies can and can't do. Here's the rules of the game of business.
That's right. We think folks have rights, that a good chunk of those rights include private property rights, and we believe that one of government's essential functions is to protect those rights.
Yeah, So we're in agreement broadly on many of these things. Now, tell me about your death by regulation project.
Yeah, you have a whole host of government regulations which are often premised on the notion that we need these to protect the public's health and safety. The focus of our Death by Regulation project is actually to look at some cases of what we see as government overregulation, where you literally have regulations that kill people, that is, that actually reduce health and safety rather than increase it, and reduce it to the point that you can even do some very rough body counts on how many victims we're talking about.
For example?
Let me give you several examples. One is a program known as CAFE, for short, the Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standards, which set minimum mile per gallon standards for every car maker's output, and which I think have a very strong lack of justification economically, but it also turns out that in addition to being economically unwise, these regulations literally kill people because they cause vehicles to be downsized. Making cars smaller and lighter is one of the most powerful means of making them more fuel efficient, but that also means that they are less crashworthy. And so according to the National Academy of Sciences, which did a very comprehensive report on this topic in 2002, the CAFE standards that we currently have probably contribute to between 1 and 3,000 additional traffic deaths per year.
So the ideal answer is for everyone to drive a Hummer?
No. I mean, look, safety is very important to lots of people, but I'm not saying it is the only criterion. But it'd be one thing if we at least had a public discussion of whether it's worth having this program, given the fact that it's got this lethal impact. In fact, however, the agency that runs this program, NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, has said next to nothing about this issue.
Yeah. Okay.
And in fact,
now Sam,
NHTSA to court about a decade ago, and a court ruled that their attempt to duck this issue was simply illegal.
Yeah, but you know, the reality is that we still live in a nation where we elect our elected representatives, and if they didn't want it, you know, if there was a strong enough public outcry, it would be toast.
No. That all depends on how things are played in the press. Look, anytime you've got a synthetic chemical that's found to possibly be killing a dozen people over a decade, you do have a strong public outcry, and that chemical quite often does become toast.
But let's go back to CAFE before we get. Let's go back to CAFE before we get to the
no public outcry.
Sure. Before we get to the chemicals, let's go back to CAFE. You said 2,000 to 3,000 people die a year because they're driving small cars that get hit by great big cars.
No. Okay. Half of all car occupant deaths are single vehicle crashes that have nothing to do with big Hummers being on the road.
Okay.
They have to do with the fact that you've got a single car hitting a phone pole or a tree or a bridge abutment.
Right.
And there you've got no one else to blame. If you had a larger car instead of a smaller car there, you would have been safer. It's clear you can make cars safer but through technology. It's clear you're safer, say, if you've got an airbag, or even safer yet, if you've buckled your lap shoulder belts. But if you do all those things in a large car, you'd be safer still.
Now you guys believe in the cost-benefit analysis way of looking at things like safety.
I'm not doing cost-benefit.
I just want to establish with you that this is a reasonable way to look at things, this cost-benefit analysis. You know, there's a cost to regulation, there's a cost to doing things, and part of that cost is human life. And we have to ask the question, you know, is there a larger benefit? Does the benefit outweigh the cost, right?
That's one thing we
broadly
should be asking.
Okay.
I'm not saying that answers
all
the
right
question, but yeah, we should be asking that.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming that you read the papers. I'm assuming that you're familiar that in 1978, well, actually, even the year before, 1997, in 1997, when Peter Arnett interviewed Osama bin Laden, he asked him what was the source of his rage.
And bin Laden identified two things very explicitly. He said, number one, that American soldiers were desecrating the soil of Saudi Arabia. American men who were not Muslim and who were drinking alcohol, and American women who were not wearing the veil and were allowed to do things like drive automobiles. And of course, that was new. That started in 1991 with the Gulf War. And secondly, he said that America was colluding with its puppet, the Saudi royal family, to drive down the price of oil below what it really should be, what most appropriately should be, which he has at various times suggested should be somewhere between $200 and $300 a barrel, and thus stealing the wealth of his homeland, of his nation. And Peter Arnett said, are you going to do anything about this? And bin Laden said yes. And Peter said, well, what are you going to do? And bin Laden said, you will see in the media, God willing. Now, I would suggest that the 3,000 people who died on 9/11 died as a consequence of our not enforcing stronger CAFE standards and our addiction to these
big cars. If we had
had
35 mile per gallon standards instead of 27.5, those 3,000 people in the trade towers would not have died.
I think that there's a very real possibility of that, Sam. And the reason why I think that there's a very real possibility of that is that between 1975 and 1985, when we first introduced CAFE standards, we cut in half the average amount of gasoline that was being used by automobiles in the United States. We doubled the efficiency of our cars. Half of the gasoline that we import right now, half of the oil that we import is used for automobiles, and we're importing 56% of our oil. If we were to double the efficiency of all the cars in the United States, we could step out of the Middle East altogether.
Look, if we were to double the fuel efficiency of our cars, I mean, I think you'd be killing quite a few people, but
the technology exists.
At least I take it you're willing to at least publicly acknowledge that that's one consequence. And that puts you at variance with folks like Sierra Club who say, oh no, CAFE is perfectly safe because it's endorsed by Ralph Nader. So I commend you on your candor here. But if you were, in fact, to double fuel economy, you would be increasing our percentage dependence on foreign oil because you'd have a very slight, possibly even non-measurable impact on world oil prices. That means you'd bring them down a bit. And since American oil supplies are the highest cost producers, that means that any time you reduce the price of oil, you make them even less competitive. You make it worth it for us to import even more oil from abroad. The more the price of oil drops, the cheaper, the more attractive Mideast oil becomes because it is the low-cost producer.
Well, Sam, I would agree with you if oil
would have had any impact on Osama.
I would agree with you if oil was a renewable resource and there was a continuously renewing supply of it. But the fact of the matter is that oil in the United States is now reaching the point where it costs $12 to $14 a barrel to pump because we're having to suck so hard in that straw. Saudi oil is down to around $8 or $9 a barrel to pump. Iraqi oil, $1.50 a gallon to pump or a barrel to pump. Because it's relatively virgin, but the reality is that we're approaching peak oil. That oil, if you go to British Petroleum's website, not exactly Greenpeace, British Petroleum's website, and you take the estimated reserves, that stuff that they haven't even found yet, plus all the known reserves, add them together and divide by current day consumption, and then add the multiplier of 2.3%, which is the current rate of increase in consumption, and a lot of people are saying that's very conservative. You end up with there being 36 years worth of oil left on the planet.
Yeah, and have you ever looked at the history of predictions that we are running out of oil? It goes back at least 75 years.
Oh, you can go back to Malthus.
Years,
I mean,
in the 1900s, the head of Geological Survey says we've passed the peak of production. We're going to run out in 5 years. Look, quite possibly you're right. And if, in fact,
should we take the chance?
Running out, oil prices are going to naturally increase. And competitive types of fuel are going to become more feasible, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I agree. In fact, I think that that's the way it's going to play out. I think I think the best thing that could happen to America is $200 a barrel of oil.
I don't know why you think that's good.
Because
you want to see people living shabby, poor types of
life. No, because it would create a dot-com boom type of revolution in innovation for alternative energy sources.
Yeah,
you don't think the American people are so stupid we can't figure out other ways to generate fuel?
New technologies are always expensive. And if that's what has to happen, that's fine. But I don't view it as a real blessing. But look, maybe you're right even there. But let's you and I agree then that since this will happen naturally, we don't need government getting itself involved with CAFE programs that kill people, yet whose lethal effect is never admitted by them.
But here's the difference, Sam. If we collectively, let's keep in mind, government is us. If we collectively don't say, hey, there's a wall at the end of this road that we're heading toward at 60 miles an hour, maybe it's time for us to slow down before we hit that wall. If we instead say, let's just put responsibility for who's driving the speed of that wall into the hands of people who are not really so concerned about the fact that there's that wall there, they're really more concerned with short-term profits because they have to answer to stockholders, is that really the best thing for American society?
No, it's not a wall. It's an incline, and its existence may or may not be correct. And if it exists, things are going to come to a new equilibrium where all these new fuels are going to be great. And by the way, some of these new fuels are going to be petroleum-based. Last year, for example,
Sam, we got 10 seconds here.
Reserve increased by 30-fold overnight. You know why? Because someone at the Geological Survey here decided that at current oil prices, the oil.
Sam, I'm going to have to let you make your. Finish making your point right after the break here, because we've got to take a break. We're the tyranny of the clock, as it were. We're talking to General Counsel, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Sam Kasman, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do they know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour. My name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Economics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Economics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Bush administration can't seem to get it right when it comes to creating jobs. In the U.S., there's a net loss of jobs. In Iraq, the Bush administration blames a clerical error for overstating the number of Iraqi jobs and projects funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The agency first said more than 88,000 were working in its projects as of September 15th, but that has changed to just under 46,000 blamed on a clerical error.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace.
The last liberal outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful and comfortable.
And now it's getting strange. We've got a war going on in Iraq. Some would say a war for oil, a part of the world where most of the oil is. We're talking with Sam Kasman, who's the general counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute and head of CEI's Death by Regulation project. Sam, CEI is CEI.org, isn't it?
That's right.
Okay, so your website, www.cei.org. Now, you quoted the Sierra Club as disagreeing with me in the earlier segment. And so, you know, I checked out their website. And here's a couple interesting things. And I quote, in a standard head-on crash test into a wall, this would be your single person accident that you were talking about. Occupants of a Ford Expedition, this is an SUV, face greater risk of injury or death than occupants of a 1997 of a Saturn subcompact. They were comparing 1977 cars of a Saturn subcompact. This is because the Saturn has crash worthiness designed into it, and the Expedition does not. You're more likely to die in an SUV.
Two specific models, but that's very possible. Look, I'm not comparing SUVs to cars. My point is, if you take any car, and add 100 pounds to it of well-designed extra material and space, you end up with a safer car. And so if you look at passenger cars generally, and all you have to do is look at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety's a website on this, you look at any class of vehicle generally, the larger ones do better in terms of crashworthiness than the smaller ones, which does not mean we all should be driving the larger ones. I don't, for example, at least in one of my cars, but I don't fool myself and think that just because you have small cars and large cars that get four-star ratings from NHTSA that they're equivalent in crashworthiness. They're not.
But we've got a war going on in the middle of an oil-rich region. We've got, you know, the entire world hating us. We've got this, you know, bizarre stuff is going on because of our addiction to oil. And we could dramatically reduce that. Again, the Sierra Club points out, raising CAFE standards to 40 miles per gallon on cars and light trucks, which is not particularly high, frankly. It's about the average in Europe right now, would save more oil than our Persian Gulf imports, offshore California drilling, and potential deposits in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Why are you opposed to that?
Because, one, I do not think it would have any real impact on our consumption. Any drop, any decline that you produce in American oil consumption is going to have the very minor effect of reducing world oil prices somewhat, which means that somewhere else, like in China, it actually spurs demand.
But they're already going up in China. I mean, it's exploding
in
China.
And it would be going up.
It's driving world oil prices
up. Sierra Club, and
so you're saying we shouldn't...
There is no loss of life from CAFE standards. I'm telling you, if you go to the Insurance Institute folks, if you go to the National Academy of Sciences report...
No, they're not saying that. What they're saying is
that
you can...
One, you find exactly...
What they're saying is that you can use technology rather than weight to produce a safe car. That you can make cars safe by using your intelligence rather than mass.
Sure you can, but the point is, once you use that technology, you then have the question of what else to do. And in fact, wage reduction and new technologies are often used in combination. And you know, you can make a safer car that's smaller because it has high-tech features and maybe it costs more, but yet if you allowed that, say, that high-tech car to be a little larger, it would be safer still. But that's not possible because you've got...
But the end point of your logic, Sam, is that we should all be driving tanks.
No,
only, or mass transit.
Only if your sole consideration when it comes to buying a car is safety.
Okay, well, that's the larger point then.
We
live in, you know, here we are in this world. We're fighting an oil war, as it were, right now. We've got, you know.
Yeah, you claim we're putting lives at risk because of oil.
Yes.
And you're upset about that. And I'm saying CAFE does the very same thing. It kills American civilians in order to save oil. But at least when we go to war, we've got the guts to say we're putting lives at risk. The folks who run CAFE, the folks who want to make CAFE even more stringent and more deadly, never have the guts to say that they're putting anyone at risk.
Well, I can't speak for the folks at CAFE,
but are on my side when it comes to that.
All right. Sam, you made your point. Sam Kasman, General Counsel to the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Sam, I got to say, I think you're absolutely wrong on this, and I know you think I am. We'll just have to leave it at that.
Okay, good talking to you.
I appreciate you being on, and hope we can talk again in the future. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
A must read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
We're calling for an end to this war.
Thousands of trade unionists assembled at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the Million Worker March on Sunday. So close to the upcoming presidential election, the event sought to shine a national spotlight on issues affecting America's workers, like the lack of health care insurance and massive job losses. In particular, many of the march's speakers called for an end to the U.S. war in Iraq. New York City Labor Against the War member Michael Letwin echoed the theme of bringing the workers' movement together with the anti-war movement.
The Million Worker March is part of a growing worldwide movement to end U.S. occupation of Iraq, to end imperial wars and occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine, the Philippines, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Haiti, to fight against the war at home that's being waged on workers, immigrants, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Larry Holmes, chairman of the International Action Center.
Who has more to lose from war and death and the money spent on war and the young people dying than working people? Right now in Iraq, the U.S.-led occupation forces have opened up a vicious new war. How many of you know about the bombing of Fallujah? It's being bombed as we speak. Untold numbers of people being killed. Iraqi and U.S. soldiers.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
In the last 4 years, we have seen the most openly destructive policies of government in the history of the United States. The policy is to enrich the rich and impoverish the poor. What's happened to wages? What's happened to jobs? And how many corporate executives are making more than $100 million a year?
The Million Worker March ended with the Solidarity March to the Hotel Washington in support of contract negotiations for 3,800 district hotel workers and locked-out employees at hotels in San Francisco.
Participants plan to hold the next administration accountable, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The U.S. trade deficit surged to $54 billion in August, ignited by a record foreign oil bill. It is the second highest level in history. Imports were also up, peaking at a record $150.1 billion. The trade deficit with China climbed to a record $18.1 billion as Americans crave more cell phones, toys, televisions, and DVD players. A coalition of textile groups have asked the Bush administration to limit the import of textiles from China in an attempt to boost textile jobs in the United States.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, there you heard it, right from the Competitive Enterprise Institute themselves. It's better to have wars for oil. I'm paraphrasing, of course, in my own words. It's better to have wars for oil where at least you're honest about it than to have people drive lighter cars that are a little less safe than a tank, and in which they may have an accident, and you know, completely ignoring the fact that as Greenpeace points out, or the Sierra Club points out, in a standard head-on crash test into a wall, occupants of a Ford Expedition, this is a 97 Ford Expedition, face greater risk of injury or death than occupants of a 77 Saturn subcompact, because the Saturn has crashworthiness designed into it and the Expedition does not. I mean, this is such a stretch. Such an incredible stretch. I want to get into some of the reasons why we have regulation. You know, what are the consequences of regulation, and why, ironically, are so many big corporations in favor of regulation? Why do they seek it? Let me share that with you after we get a quick news update here from Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, how's Washington, D.C. today?
It's beautiful, absolutely fantastic today.
That's marvelous. So what's the news?
Well, the news is that earlier this morning I was at the White House. President Bush signed this Homeland Security and Terrorism Bill into law, and then he had a reception on the South Lawn for Paralympians and Olympians, which was all very friendly. Ended, in fact, with him kissing a man on the head.
Just like he did John McCain.
Well, he was a Paralympian in a wheelchair, and he leaned over and kissed him on top of the head. So,
amazing.
So that was fascinating.
Isn't that sweet?
We had that, and now he's in New Jersey, as I'm sure you know, giving what's been called a major terrorism speech. But, of course, he did that a few weeks ago and said it was going to be a major policy speech, and it ended up being a campaign speech. Yeah. And I suspect it's the same thing. So we're in a situation where we have the cable news networks carrying this speech, which is probably a campaign stump speech.
Sure. Well, and has been for 3.5 years. I mean, Lee Atwater developed the idea of, you know, the perpetual campaign, that you start campaigning the day after you're inaugurated. And this administration has been doing that. I mean, it's unambiguous. They've been it's so apparent.
Right.
Yeah. So what else is up?
Well, that's really the main thing. Obviously, we're hearing a certain amount about Theresa Hines Carey's tax returns, and this is becoming a bit of a story, as is whether her money would be influencing John Kerry if he got into the White House. And I've heard this a couple of times now, and it struck me that, you know, I've been expecting a whisper campaign directed against Theresa Hines Carey, and I wonder if this is the nature of it, that it's going to go after her money.
Yeah, these guys are very.
These
guys are very good at whisper campaigns. You read
yeah.
this? Was it in Harper's or the Atlantic Monthly that had the piece about Karl Rove this month?
I think it was in the Atlantic Monthly.
Yeah.
But also in Bush's Brain by Wayne Slater, he talks in detail about the whisper campaign.
Yeah, this is one of Rove's signature devices, and so you know there's no doubt that that's going to be. You know, what's Teresa's money going to do to John? I'm wondering what George Bush Sr.'s billions in Carlisle are going to do to George W. I mean, you know, it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you want to get into that,
well, that's a good question.
Yeah. So, okay. So, what do you expect coming up here this week?
How do you mean? Oh, coming up during the week?
Yeah.
Well, really, there's nothing going on in Washington in terms of Congress. They come back on, I think it's November the 16th for a lame duck session. They've got a lot of appropriations and other financial-type bills to deal with and basically to keep the government running. So that'll be coming up then. But really, everyone's cleared out. Everyone's campaigning like mad. And Washington is... It's following a horse race. It's got its eyes on the polls and, you know, just waiting to see what's going to happen next. And, you know, it's interesting, another of Karl Rove's maxims, because people have been asking questions about why is George Bush going to New Jersey, because even though it's moved slightly more in his direction, it's probably not going to go for him. And Karl Rove's thing has always been that in the last couple of weeks of a campaign, he believes that if you act like you've won, that people follow the polls.
Sure.
So the more you act like you're winning, even if you're not, and you speak with huge confidence that you've got an 8-point lead and things like that, people start to believe it, and people start to come on your side because they want to vote for the winner.
Yeah, it's called the bandwagon effect.
Right, and it seems as though this, certainly according to some, that this may be what President Bush is doing in New Jersey. I don't know if that's the case or not.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Makes perfect sense. Are you going to be with us on Friday at the Heritage Foundation for this?
I certainly am.
Okay, great. Well, we'll see you then.
Oh, looking forward to it.
All right. Have a good day, Victoria. Thanks for the call. Always great
to
hear
from you.
You
too. Bye-bye.
Talk to you tomorrow. Bye now. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. So back to regulation. Regulation basically does three things. Number one, and this was its original purpose, the original purpose of regulation. And it's real important to understand two and three, by the way. These are the things that most people are unaware of. But number one, regulation protects us against against predators. I mentioned in the first hour how in a community of only a few hundred people, you know what's going on. I mean, I live in a little town of 9,000 people here in central Vermont. And if there's a bad doctor in town, everybody knows it. If you got a restaurant that's serving food that makes people sick, everybody knows it. You can't, you know, it's just you can't get away from it. I mean, there's an upside and downside to that. I give a speech in town, and the next day I walk around and everybody knows me, and I don't know them. You know, it's a little disconcerting, frankly. But in any case, everybody knows what's going on in a small community. But what about, you know, New York City? What about Philadelphia? What about the United States of America? What about at the level of a state or national government? There are predators out there. The reality is that there are people who would prey on other people. There are people who would harm other people in order to fulfill their own goals. There are people who would lie to us in order to fulfill their own economic agenda or to gain power. How do we protect ourselves from them? And, you know, yes, in a small community, you protect yourself by knowledge. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. Let the market know. And this, of course, is the message that all the cons carry out. You know, oh, we just get rid of all this regulation. People will figure out who's good and who's bad. The market will work, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But not until thousands of people have died or been ripped off. I mean, the reality is that once society grows larger than 150 people, we have to create institutions within our society that reflect the will and values of our society and that protect our society. We call those institutions government. And so the first purpose of good regulation is to protect us against the predators. Now, what's happened, and that's really where it started, and that goes back to the, I mean, literally this goes back to the 1700s. However, In the mid-20th century, some very large corporations figured out that there were two other uses for regulation and started aggressively using regulation to further the goal of those two purposes. The first is to legalize behavior that might otherwise be illegal, and the second is to keep out their smaller competitors. And I realize this may even sound just a little counterintuitive, but this is very much the way it is. For example, in 1986, Reagan was president, George Bush Sr. was vice president. In 1986, there were no genetically modified products in the marketplace. None. Several companies were developing them. Monsanto, probably the largest. And, you know, with their Roundup Ready products, you know, that they've now come out with, and BT corn and whatnot. Anyhow, and so as a Monsanto executive, Leonard Guerrera, told the New York Times in 2001, there were no products at the time, but we bugged him for regulation, him being Vice President George Bush. We told him we have to be regulated. Now, this is before the products have been brought to market. Why is an executive of Monsanto going to George Bush, the vice president, and saying, please create regulations regarding genetically modified organisms? Why? Well, as I said, the reasons are, number one, it legalizes something. Number two, if the regulations are sufficiently complex, it keeps out small competitors. And just very straightforward. And in fact, under the regulations shepherded through government agencies by the White House, George Bush did their bidding, George Bush Sr., back in 1986. He did their bidding. And under those regulations, the dangers of genetically modified foods would be determined by whom? By us? By we the people? By a regulatory agency? No. The dangers of the genetically modified organisms would be determined by the manufacturers, not the government. And this was put into regulation. And testing would occur whenever the companies wanted it to. See, this is an end run. Not only that, they wanted to include in the regulations a proviso that said that it's illegal to tell a consumer if there's a genetically modified product in what they're eating. I mean, we're in a situation right now where in 1998, the latest statistics that I have, genetically altered corn accounted for 32% of the crop, the U.S. crop, 38% for soybeans, 58% for canola oil. And my understanding is, I mean, that was 6 years ago, that we're looking at now like 70-80% with regard to corn and soybeans. And cotton is very high. I don't know the exact numbers as of 2004. By and large, they're not released. But the New York Times, in an article by Kurt Eichenwald back in 2001, reporting on this story, said, and I quote the New York Times, labeling was ruled out as potentially misleading to the consumer, since it might suggest there was reason for concern. Yes, it's misleading to the consumer to tell them if there's a genetically modified product in their food. Can't do it. Now, you know, on the other hand, in some cases, industries want to regulate things because they want complex regulations that are so complex. The pharmaceutical companies are particularly good at this. They want regulations that are sufficiently complex that they can easily afford to hire 3 full-time lawyers just to deal with the paperwork. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the billions that they're making. But if some small entrepreneurial venture decides that they've got an idea for a product, somebody invents something, they want to bring it to market, they can't afford to deal with the regulation. They can't jump through the hoops. And so they end up having to go to the big corporation. In other words, regulations are a barrier to entrepreneurial activity. And this is not a negative byproduct of regulation. This is the desired effect of regulation from the corporate viewpoint. This is why we see that the vast majority of regulations are actually written by corporations themselves. Under the Bush administration, it's safe to say virtually all of the regulations that have been written by industry itself. In 1970, the Clean Air Act was passed, And the industry launched such a huge lobbying effort to fight the regulation on toxic chemicals after the passage of the Clean Air Act in 1970, this on Nixon's watch, that by 1990, the agency had been able to muster regulations for exactly 7 of the 191 toxic chemicals that fell under the original legislation. The original clean air legislation, named 191 compounds to be regulated. Industry said, no, we all, you know, and they whittled it down to 7. Today, 7.7 billion pounds of toxics are directly released into our air every year. 80,000 artificial chemicals, things that didn't exist when our great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were on Earth, when Native Americans walked across this land uninhibited. 80,000 chemicals being generated by industry in the United States. How many of those chemicals are regulated? So this gets back to the first purpose of regulation, which is protect us from the predators. 650 out of the 80,000. That's about 1% of all the chemicals in use have ever been tested for toxicity. And we have a situation now where, you know, male fish are producing eggs and frogs have three legs and extra hind legs, and cancer rates are soaring. And girls are starting to menstruate at the age of 8 and 9, and everybody's scratching their head and everybody's scratching their head and going, what's going on? Well, we don't know. Why don't we know? Because the industry got regulation passed that prevents us from knowing. It should be called anti-regulation. But back to CAFE standards. One of the few regulations, right here, because fuel economy for cars doubled between 1975 and the late 1980s, a new car purchaser saves an average of more than $3,000 at the gas pump over the lifetime of the car. Consumer savings from regulation. Additionally, CAFE delivers more than $40 billion in consumer savings. This, by the way, from the Sierra Club. It's just remarkable. If fuel economy goes up, and we certainly can do this. I mean, not only is this not rocket science, every other country has already done it. As fuel economy goes up, you and I end up with more money in our pocket, which means we can spend more money on other things other than oil to the oil industry, CEOs Cheney and Bush, and life gets better. 10 minutes before the hour.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Do you have a dust mask? Well, if you use a bagless vacuum and you're sensitive to dust, a leading consumer magazine products testing magazine warns you should wear a dust mask. But here's a better idea. Try my newest hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL risk-free for 30 days. It uses triple-walled disposable filter bags. Try emptying a bagless vacuum and see what happens. Dust gets all over your hands and face and back into the room and on the kitchen counter. And you get to breathe it in? I believe a vacuum should capture the dust, not your lungs. That's why with my Auric XL, the filter bags are self-sealing. What goes in the bag stays in the bag, even when you empty it. So try my hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Then if you still want a bagless vacuum, I'll send you a dust mask to wear.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. George Bush predicted his tax cuts would create an average of 300,000 new jobs per month, but the latest numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics are out, and only 96,000 payroll jobs were created in September. And, according to the Economic Policy Institute, that's well below the pace of job creation earlier this year. Lee Price, research director with the EPI, says at least 150,000 new jobs would need to be created per month just to keep up with population growth.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
Manufacturing jobs fell by 18,000, and EPI economist Jared Bernstein says the report reveals a slower-growing labor force with an employment decline of over 200,000 in this month's household survey.
Private sector jobs in the service sector, private sector jobs were up 72,000, but 33,000 of those were in temporary help, and that job pays well below average and signals a continuing sign of employers' cautious hiring practices.
Up from last month, long-term unemployment of 6 months or more reached 22% in September.
This signals that many potential job seekers are avoiding job searchers in what's a pretty weak labor environment. But most importantly, since these people who are not in the labor market are not counted among the unemployed, it tells us that 5.4% unemployment rate paints too rosy a picture of just how tight the labor market is.
Since October 2002, more than one-fifth of unemployed workers have been without a job for at least half a year, the largest and longest stretch since 1948. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I love my country so much, man. Like an exasperating friend. Dum 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 dum.
And welcome back. It helps to turn up the mic there. Always a good plan. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. I don't want to beat this regulation horse to death. I think it's really important that people understand this and understand that particularly in Republican administrations, but in Democratic administrations as well, the regulations are very often written by the regulated for the benefit of the regulated, not for the benefit of we the people. And the solution to this is for us to get politically engaged. We have to become part of the solution. We have to participate in democracy if we're going to even have democracy. Otherwise, we're just abrogating our responsibility. Speaking of participating, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Armin from Sarasota, Florida, is on the line. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Two quick points. 15 months ago, I had a heart attack. 6 months ago, I thought I had the bill straightened out. Now I'm getting a bill today from the physician discharging me, and we had it all corrected from the physician's office that I was not to be billed for that because the physician wasn't there on my discharge.
Right.
So this is Bush's health care in America. The bills keep flowing. If the malpractice doesn't kill you, the bills will eat you up.
Go ahead.
I'd like to go on further to describe the Bush regime for the simple people out there that want simple explanations to try to understand what they're all about.
They're all about cheap labor. You know?
What?
Cheap labor. That's the bottom line.
No, no. PNAC propaganda. PNAC propaganda.
Okay, that's their foreign
propaganda.
Policy.
Yeah. PNAC propaganda.
Okay.
PNAC propaganda.
Got it, Larman. Got it. Thanks a lot. PNAC propaganda. PNAC, of course, is the Project for a New American Century, which back in 1998 wrote a letter to Bill Clinton, signed by Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Jeb Bush, and a bunch of these other neocons. I believe James Woolsey might have been on there, the CIA director, saying, please invade Iraq immediately. And, you know, their worldview, their basic worldview is the worldview of empire. And we are seeing this, the horrors of the declining years of empire right now as a consequence of these neoconservative policies. And PNAC, Project for New American Century, as Armin correctly points out, is the nexus of evil, as it were. It's the nexus of this worldview that we can simply take over other nations, impose democracy on them, and somehow they will love us forever and do our bidding and do our work. And, you know, it ain't working. It didn't work in Vietnam. It's not working in Iraq. And it's time to throw these bums out and have a rational vision. Let's return to some of the policies that have kept this nation strong for hundreds and hundreds of years. We can do it on November 2nd.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
It's time for This Billionaire Moment.
A criminal investigation is underway over Halliburton's $180 million payment to Nigerian officials for a natural gas project back when Dick Cheney was the CEO. Critics call this bribery, but in many countries, bribes are just part of the political culture. Why should Dick's company be punished for being sensitive to local customs? You give money to politicians and they give favors to you. We do it all the time here in the U.S., only we call it a campaign contribution, and no one seems to object. South of the border, it's la mordita, the little bite, and in the Middle East, it's bakshish. No matter what you call it, it's smart business. I'm Zina Fobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaire!
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
We're calling for an end to this war.
Thousands of trade unionists assembled at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the Million Worker March on Sunday. So close to the upcoming presidential election, the event sought to shine a national spotlight on issues affecting America's workers, like the lack of health care insurance and massive job losses. In particular, many of the march's speakers called for an end to the U.S. war in Iraq. New York City Labor Against the War member Michael Letwin echoed the theme of bringing the workers' movement together with the anti-war movement.
The Million Worker March is part of a growing worldwide movement to end U.S. occupation of Iraq, to end imperial wars and occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine, the Philippines, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Haiti, to fight against the war at home that's being waged on workers, immigrants, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Larry Holmes, chairman of the International Action Center.
Who has more to lose from war and death and the money spent on war and the young people dying than working people? Right now in Iraq, the U.S.-led occupation forces have opened up a vicious new war. How many of you know about the bombing of Fallujah? It's being bombed as we speak. Untold numbers of people being killed. Iraqi and U.S. soldiers.
former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
In the last 4 years, we have seen the most openly destructive policies of government in the history of the United States. The policy is to enrich the rich and impoverish the poor. What's happened to wages? What's happened to jobs? And how many corporate executives are making more than $100 million a year?
The Million Worker March ended with a solidarity march to the Hotel Washington in support of contract negotiations for 3,800 district hotel workers and locked-out employees at hotels in San Francisco. Participants plan to hold the next administration accountable, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The U.S. trade deficit surged to $54 billion in August, ignited by a record foreign oil bill. It is the second highest level in history. Imports were also up, peaking at a record $150.1 billion. The trade deficit with China climbed to a record $18.1 billion as Americans crave more cell phones, toys, televisions, and DVD players. A coalition of textile groups have asked the Bush administration to limit the import of textiles from China in an attempt to boost textile jobs in the United States.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So, Jasper, how was your year?
Excellent. This administration gives the best returns ever.
Do tell.
Well, the money I paid to a lobbying firm in Washington brought in over $50 million in overseas contracts.
Oh, yes, lobbying pays.
Are you still into commodities, Max?
No, I'm funding politicians. My campaign contributions got me over $100 million worth of regulation waivers.
Well done, Max.
Today's wisest investments are in politics. Where are you throwing your money?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Maybe you're one of the 2 million Americans who've recently had their jobs offshore to India, Pakistan, and elsewhere, or one of the millions more expected to have your job shipped abroad in the next few years. If so, don't worry, bucko, for a new growth industry has arisen that offers exciting job opportunities for you discarded Americans. You too could become an American accent and culture trainer. It seems that while such corporations as Citibank, Dell, GE, and Microsoft are eager to abandon the U.S. and move their telephone service jobs to low-wage workers abroad, these English-speaking foreign workers are, well, foreign. So their accents and cultural references can be jarring to U.S. customers placing orders or seeking help. Thus, offshoring companies are hiring Americans to teach foreign replacement workers to sound and behave like Americans. Yes, this means you could end up teaching the Indian or Pakistani or Russian who was given your job how to sound like you. Courses in American Culture 101 include U.S. history memorization, American slang, basic sports knowledge, and pop culture. Quick, what's the Lone Star State? Who are the Florida Marlins? Can you name one talent that Britney Spears has? What's a burrito? The lesson plans for these courses include having to watch episodes of Friends and screening such films as Bruce Almighty. As for accents, there are voice exercises for Indians, for example, to help them lower their natural high-pitched and clipped pronunciation of English. And if the exercises are not enough, the corporate call centers use technology to filter the telephone voices of the foreign service reps, making them sound lower than they are. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, it won't be long before the corporations train low-paid foreigners to teach American accents and culture to foreign workers. Then there'll be no need for American workers at all.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big, evil taco is haunting me. You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get Score Power from Equifax.com. Score Power gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get Score Power at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. Score Power at Equifax.com.
Thank you.
man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I was walking into my apartment, says Andrea Macris. Walking into my apartment, and there was a man inside my building. She told this to CNN's Anderson Cooper on Friday night. She says, I don't have a doorman. He had somehow got into my building, and he was hiding behind my stairwell. He said, oh, you're her. He hit me in the chest with the papers and said, you're served. They're threatening me. They're frightening me, Macris said. Yes, I'm rattled, but I'm really strong. Looks like Bill O'Reilly may have finally come up against somebody that is able to take him on. They're saying, oh, one of her lawyers is a Democrat. Therefore, this is a woman who is an intern for George Bush Sr. and who enthusiastically went to work for Bill O'Reilly. She's a conservative. But he's what we're seeing is perhaps the self-destruction. I mean, it's I'm always fascinated by people who are driven, obsessively driven, I want to say ego, but I think it goes beyond that. It's not just a need to be loved or a need to be recognized. It's a need to crush others. It's a demagogic or demagogic, however you say the word, instinct. And I think it's a very dangerous one and a very destructive one. We have in the deposition, Andrea Macris says that Bill O'Reilly said to her about Al Franken, my colleague and competitor. He says, if you cross Fox News Channel, it's not just me. It's Fox President Roger Ailes who will go after you. Roger Ailes, of course, being the former Republican operative and head of the Reagan, you know, or big shot in the Reagan and Bush White Houses that was tapped by Rupert Murdoch to create the Fox News Network, who generates the memo, the famous memo that says to all the news reporters on Fox how each day they have to spin the news. Anyhow, O'Reilly says, it's not just me. It's Fox News President Roger Ailes who will go after you. I'm the street guy up front making loud noises about the issue, but Ailes operates behind the scenes, strategizes, and makes things happen so that one day, bam, person gets what's coming to them but never sees it coming. Look at Al Franken. One day he's going to get a knock on his door, and life as he's known will change forever. That day will happen. Trust me. And she's like, what? What are you talking about? And he goes, Ailes knows very powerful people. This goes all the way to the top. Macris says, to the top of what? He says, to the top of the country. Just look who's on the cover of his book. Ailes' book. The people on the cover of his book are Bush and Cheney. They're watching him. And will be for years. Al Franken's finished, and he's going to be sorry he ever took on Fox News Channel. This is, you know, I think it's useful for us to realize, to understand, to have a sense of what it means to be such a bully. By the way, if I neglected to say so at the opening of the show, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866. 889-8894 if you'd like to call in. Our chat room, our archives, both the White Rose Society archives and the TomHartman.com archives that Mike Toth puts together, you can find by going to TomHartman.com. And articles on democracy, I think you'll find is a fascinating collection of writings. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff, things on my books and whatnot. But anyhow, TomHartman.com, 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. But let's hear Bill O'Reilly in his own words. I play this with permission of the producer of the Terry Gross Show. This is from some time ago. This is from a few months ago. Bill O'Reilly revealed how he really treats, I'm inclined to say treats women. Obviously, Andrea Macris thinks that being a woman puts a person much more at risk for being treated this way by O'Reilly. But certainly we've all seen him treat men this way as well. It's just the bully coming out.
I'll read with the People magazine.
And hang on just a second here. Got to push. Plug in the old plug. Okay, let's try it one more time. She's going to, Terry Gross interviewing Bill O'Reilly, she asks him, aren't people afraid of reviewing your book because they're afraid if they say the wrong thing, you will mock them on TV. You'll make fun of them. And he says, well, it depends on how they review the book and whether they attack me or what's in the book. And then she goes on to say, she says, well, let's do a for example.
I'll read what the People magazine thinks.
Why? Why read it? Why read it?
I guess I want people to hear it.
Why?
Because it.
Why?
You'll hear when I'm done why.
I'm getting a feeling in this interview, all right, that this is just a hatchet job.
See, this, by the way, is called taking control of the interview. It's something everybody who, in talk radio, and television, anybody who does interview shows, you don't want this to happen. You don't let the other person take control. It's like what happened when George Bush stepped all over Charlie the other day, the moderator in the second debate. Here O'Reilly is doing it, and he is not going to let go.
On me, all right? And I don't like it. Now, there's no reason for you to read that People magazine review. If they want to read it, they can go and read it.
No, but this isn't a review of the book.
See, it's a review of the book. There is a reason for her to read it. She's setting up a question. It's part of her script. But he's saying, no, she can't have her own show.
It's the review of how you handled it. And I think
it doesn't make any
difference.
It's
okay to ask you to be accountable for the things you said.
Accountable for what? I came on this program to talk about who's looking out for you. And what you have done is thrown every kind of defamation you can in my face. All right, did you do this to Al Franken? Did you?
Al Franken being his... personal obsession now. Again, as he said, well, look at Al Franken. One day he's going to get a knock on his door, and life as he's known it will change forever. This is sounding more and more like the mafia than talk radio or anything like that.
Did you challenge him on what he said?
We had a different interview.
Yeah, a different interview. Okay, fine. Fresh air? Is this what fresh air is?
Attack the messenger rather than the message. Go after them personally. Try to get somebody emotionally. Harm them. Terrify them.
I'll get a transcript of this interview. You want me of the Al Franken interview? You want me to do that and compare
you're
the
welcome.
Two?
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And compare
to.
The two. You
want,
all right. Why don't
welcome.
You tell your listeners right now? Were you as tough on Al Franken as you are on me?
No.
You were.
I wasn't.
Okay. Why?
Well, Al Franken had written a book of political satire.
Oh, he was satire now, was it? Calling people liars and distorting their faces on the book cover, that's satire now, is it? And my book, Who's Looking Out for You, is designed to help people, to show them how they have to know how to read people in this society to succeed. Yet you're easy on Franken and you challenge me. This is NPR. Okay, I think we all know what this is. I think we all know where you're going with this.
Well,
don't we?
Well, you can think,
yeah,
you can think whatever you want
I
to.
I am. I mean, I'm evaluating this interview very closely.
Obviously,
now,
you
we've
are.
We've spent now, all right, 50 minutes of me being defending defamation against me in every possible way.
Actually, I'm looking at the clock here. It's 2 minutes, 40 seconds, but in any case.
While you gave Al Franken a complete pass on his defamatory book. And if you think that's fair, Terry, then you need to get in another business. I'll tell you that right now. And I'll tell your listeners if you have the courage to put this on the air. This is basically an unfair interview designed to try to trap me into saying something.
See, putting my psychotherapist hat on, I mean, this almost sounds like clinical paranoia.
That Harpers can use. And you know it, and you should be ashamed of yourself. And that is the end of this interview.
Oh, so you're not even going to give me the chance to ask you a follow-up question. You have to make a speech and then have the last word? You're gone. Okay, I guess that's the answer to that question. He's walked out. Okay, well, my guest has been Bill O'Reilly, and he does have a new book.
And on it goes. So, remarkable. So now Bill O'Reilly... perhaps for the first time in his life, is being called to task, as it were, is being held accountable for the things that he's done and said. Oh, interesting. Interesting. But there's lots of other things in the news, but that's not going to go away, and because it has a celebrity factor, it's going to get more juice. We'll see how it plays out. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Kevin in Florida, is on the line. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
The fiasco's already started in Florida.
Oh, there's lawsuits about the fiasco in Florida.
Well, let me tell you what, I personally was involved in one right now.
Oh, cool. What happened?
Here in Hillsborough County, which is Tampa, the early voting's being held at the libraries. Mm-hmm. There's like 18 of them, I think, in the county.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm working with the Kerry campaign. I'm also working with a friend of mine who is the Democratic candidate for the Supervisor of Elections. The current holder of the office is a Republican appointee of Jeb Bush.
What a surprise.
After the last one became the mayor of Tampa, who is a Democrat.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we had big problems in the primary on August 31st. There was one machine which was never taken out of test mode, and 245 votes were never counted because it was in testing mode, not on mode.
Hmm.
Those kinds of things. Anyway, at one of the... Actually, the library that had the largest number of early votes in the last primary,
mm-hmm.
People went in to vote today. And the early voting, one of the things for it is you don't have to wait in line.
Right.
They're waiting an hour and a half. And what's happened is it seems that the machines are working, but their computers don't work. So they can't log into downtown to take the person off the list and to verify that they are a registered voter.
Mm-hmm.
So every person that comes in has to be called and manually searched downtown and then manually checked off.
Hmm.
And like I said, people are waiting an hour and a half to vote. And some people are coming in and seeing these big lines and then they're leaving.
Is this an area that's principally Democratic?
Very heavy Democratic. It's actually mixed.
Uh-huh.
There's upper middle class. This would be like Norman Schwarzkopf, if he was voting early, because he lives around here.
Yeah.
He's one of my neighbors in this sense.
Uh-huh.
He would go to that library to vote.
Interesting.
So there are some very...
So this is more likely. So, Kevin, do you think this is a screw-up, or do you think this is an attempt to suppress the vote and control the election?
It could be both. This supervisor of election is a screw-up. He's messed up every election he's been involved in here since he took over. And this is just a continuation. And I'm hearing that stuff is happening over in West Palm today, too.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks, Kevin, for the call. I appreciate it.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. All of the attention given to Halliburton and their no-bid contract in Iraq would make you think that it is not a regular practice. But a new report from the Center of Public Integrity reveals that at least $362 billion was spent on no-bid contracts by the Pentagon since 1998. But the Pentagon did not stop there, rewarding $255 billion in cost-plus contracts that allow companies to spend as much as they deem necessary on a job, including an agreed-upon profit.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
The billionaires don't want you to vote. If you're happy with George Bush in charge, if you want to keep us living large, do you really want to rock the boat? Hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote.
That's amazing. This weekend I spoke at the Bioneers Conference in San Rafael, California on Saturday. And what an incredible gig. Bioneers.org, I'm guessing, is their website. It was absolutely amazing, 3,500 people there and some of the most brilliant thinkers on the planet. I was on a panel with Amy Goodman, who does Democracy Now!, and then I was on a panel with Thomas Lindsay, who runs CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which has sued, you know, something over 100 now organizations or townships have sued, over 100 townships, nearly 100 townships in Pennsylvania have passed laws saying, in our town, corporations don't have constitutional rights. I mean, this is a big deal. And so, but the billionaires for Bush were there. They had a booth, and they got up and they did a thing. I mean, this they're springing up all over the country. There's a Vermont chapter. It's just wonderful to see this kind of political satire. You almost, you know, almost don't want Bush to get voted out of office because there's he has been the lightning rod to bring out so much citizen activism, so much of a return to participatory democracy in the United States. You know, on the other hand, he's done so much damage to the United States and killed so many people that he's if we fail to remove him on November 2nd, it's going to be a real tragedy, and both for the United States, for the world, and for democracy, in my opinion. 17 members of an Army Reserve platoon, according to WLBT in Jackson, Mississippi, 17 members of an Army Reserve platoon were read their rights and moved from their barracks to tents Wednesday when they refused to go on what's been called a suicide mission. This has been in the news. This is probably not the first you've heard about it. Sergeant Larry McCook has been in the military for over 10 years. He's a deputy at the Hinds County Detention Center, this in Mississippi. Sergeant William Butler has been on in service for more than 24 years. He's a carpenter with the Jackson Public Schools. 20-year-old Aaron Gardner of Vicksburg was also arrested. These are all people apparently in the Jackson, Mississippi area. And Pat McCook, talking about this, she told WLBT, it was a suicide mission they were basically sending them on. Why would you put someone in a vehicle that's unsafe in a hostile territory? You're just setting them up for failure. You're setting them up for ambush. I don't want that to happen to my husband. She says she received a call Friday and was told her husband and the other members of the platoon had been released. I mean, you gotta get it that there's something really, really wrong with the prosecution of this thing, of this so-called war. When your own soldiers are mutinying, you know, engaging in mutiny, are refusing to take orders. George Bush is increasingly looking like, what was it, Captain Queeg on the HMS Bounty? I'm sure somebody in our chat room will know and set me straight. I can let you know about it after the next break, or somebody can call in. But anyhow, who was the guy that, you know, mutiny on the Bounty, the loony leader that everybody said, you know, somebody finally did the Emperor Has No Clothes moment, you know, and said, you know, this guy is nuts. This guy is crazy. He's putting all our lives at risk. Well, the mask continues to be torn off the friendly fascism of the Bush administration. President Bush taught three Oregon school teachers a new lesson in irony Thursday night, last Thursday, when his campaign removed them from a Bush speech and threatened them with arrest, simply wearing T-shirts that said, and I quote, "Protect our civil liberties," end quote. Under the new rules, if you want to go see Bush speak and you wear a T-shirt that says "Protect our civil liberties," you may be arrested and imprisoned. Janet Voorhees, 48 years old, a teacher in training. Tanis Tong, 34, special education teacher. She says, we chose this phrase specifically because we thought it wouldn't be offensive or degrading or obscene. Protect our civil liberties. To say so is now a crime in Bush World. 29 minutes past the hour.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
We're calling for an end to this war.
Thousands of trade unionists assembled at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the Million Worker March on Sunday. So close to the upcoming presidential election, the event sought to shine a national spotlight on issues affecting America's workers, like the lack of health care insurance and massive job losses. In particular, many of the march's speakers called for an end to the U.S. war in Iraq. New York City Labor Against the War member Michael Letwin echoed the theme of bringing the workers' movement together with the anti-war movement.
The Million Worker March is part of a growing worldwide movement to end U.S. occupation of Iraq, to end imperial wars and occupations of Afghanistan, Palestine, the Philippines, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Haiti, to fight against the war at home that's being waged on workers, immigrants, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Larry Holmes, chairman of the International Action Center.
Who has more to lose from war and death and the money spent on war and the young people dying than working people? Right now in Iraq, the U.S.-led occupation forces have opened up a vicious new war. How many of you know about the bombing of Fallujah? It's being bombed as we speak. Untold numbers of people being killed. Iraqi and U.S. soldiers.
former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
In the last 4 years, we have seen the most openly destructive policies of government in the history of the United States. The policy is to enrich the rich and impoverish the poor. What's happened to wages? What's happened to jobs? And how many corporate executives are making more than $100 million a year?
The Million Worker March ended with the Solidarity March to the Hotel Washington in support of contract negotiations for 3,800 district hotel workers and locked-out employees at hotels in San Francisco. Participants plan to hold the next administration accountable, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The U.S. trade deficit surged to $54 billion in August, ignited by a record foreign oil bill. It is the second highest level in history. Imports were also up, peaking at a record $150.1 billion. The trade deficit with China climbed to a record $18.1 billion as Americans crave more cell phones, toys, televisions, and DVD players. A coalition of textile groups have asked the Bush administration to limit the import of textiles from China in an attempt to boost textile jobs in the United States.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Of the sun, and this will be our year. Took a long time to come. Don't let go of my hand now. Darkness.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, we're going to do a contest here. These are so much fun. And I'm gonna actually answer the phones here, Rama. If somebody, you know, if anybody calls in before I have a chance to get to it, just, you know, punch it up and put them on hold. No need to say anything. Just punch it up and push the hold button so I can grab them. Because you know, sometimes if it gets into one of the higher lines, it'll roll over into a machine. But we're gonna give away, and please don't call until after I've read the question and the four possible answers, so that you can appropriately pick the answer. What we're going to give away is a bumper sticker up at the top in about half-inch high letters. It says Bush, and it has a flag, and it's got the round circle with a diagonal through it, you know, the international symbol for no. And then in great big letters on a red field with white type and red, white, and blue stars, in great big letters it says, Bring Back Monica Lewinsky. So if you'd like a bumper sticker that says, No Bush, Bring Back Monica Lewinsky. And no, I didn't mean that as a pun. Our number for the contest, you may want to write this down because you can't call it until I have read the last answer. The number is 1-866-889-8894. 866-889-8894. I'll repeat it again after I read the last question. And let's see, number 14. Okay, here's the question selected by Rama Schneider, who's here handling the phones for us today and helping engineer the program. And how, this, by the way, from the George W. Bush quiz book by Paul Slansky, which is a marvelous piece of literature. The question is, how did George W. Bush reach out to McCain voters after defeating him for the Republican presidential nomination, this back in 2000. How did he reach out to McCain voters after he beat McCain? Here are the four possible answers. A, he told a reporter that McCain, quote, didn't change my views, end quote, on campaign reform or, for that matter, on anything else. B, responding to a reporter's observation that McCain had inspired record voter turnouts in the primaries, he snapped, well then, how come he didn't win? C, asked if there was anything he regretted about the vicious campaign he waged, he shot back, like what? Give me an example. What should I regret? Or D, all of the above. What did George W. Bush do to reach out to McCain voters after defeating him for the Republican presidential nomination. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. I'm just going to put you on the air, ask your name and city and what, you know, A, B, C, or D. A, he told a reporter that McCain didn't change my views on campaign reform, finance reform, or for that matter on anything else. B, responding to a reporter's observation that McCain had inspired record voter turnouts in the primaries, he snapped, "Well then, how come he didn't win?" C, asked if there was anything he regretted about the vicious campaign he waged, he shot back, "Like what? Give me an example. What should I regret?" Or D, all of the above. 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to enter the contest for a Bring Back Monica Lewinsky bumper sticker. Hello, caller. What's your name and what city are you in?
Kevin, South Lake Tahoe, California.
Okay, Kevin. Which is it, A, B, C, or D? Kevin?
I'll say D.
You'll take D, all of the above. Okay,
correct.
Kevin, as you know, we've got to start asking harder questions here, Rama. Kevin, you won. You absolutely won. That's right, and all the other lines are lit up. Rama, stop calling. Don't call. We have a winner. And, Rama, you'll just have to tell the other folks or just ask them if they want to go on the show, if they got something they want to say. You know, people are welcome to hang around and be on the program, but... No more contestants. Okay, just so we know what Kevin won, and what here the question was: how did George Bush reach out to McCain voters after defeating him for the presidential nomination? He did all three of these things. A, he told a reporter that McCain didn't change his mind on campaign reform, or for that matter, anything else. B, he responding to a reporter's observation that McCain had inspired record voter turnouts in the primaries, he snapped, "Well then, how come he didn't win?" And C, asked if there was anything he regretted about the vicious campaign he waged, he shot back, "Like what? Give me an example. What should I regret?" And, of course, the answer is D, all of the above. Kevin, you win a Bring Back Monica Lewinsky bumper sticker, and I'm going to put you on hold so that Rama can come in here and grab the bumper sticker from my hand and address it with your name and address so that we can drop it in the mail and get it out to you. So congratulations, Kevin.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hang on just a minute, and we'll get this thing to you. So moving along with the program, I've got a couple more really cool bumper stickers. We'll do a few more contests here before the election. But we've got to come up with tougher questions. We've got to come up with tougher questions, as it's, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's great that Kevin won. I'm really pleased. And it would be, you know, it'd be fun to have a few people give wrong answers. Finally, a federal appeals court has done the right thing. Of course, this may well be appealed to the Supreme Court, and then it's going to depend on who's elected president in 2 weeks, because that person is going to appoint a couple of Supreme Court justices. And, you know, anyhow, here's the story. This is from CNN, CNN.com. Fears of a terrorist attack are not sufficient reason for authorities to search people at a protest, a federal appeals court has ruled, saying 9/11, quote, cannot be the day liberty perished. You know, this is becoming so obvious to me in interviews with and the debates and the whole thing that Bush and Cheney and their guys are trying very much to pursue the policy that Hitler pursued after the Reichstaggebouge was burned, which is use an attack on the nation to terrorize the people. Even Roosevelt didn't do that after Pearl Harbor. Certainly he used it as a symbol of the fact that we were at war. He used it to overcome Republican opposition to participating in World War II. But he didn't use it to terrorize the American people. Instead, he used it to mobilize the American people, to get the American people active and involved, to get them making sacrifices, to get them participating. And these guys, the Bush administration, they want to use these things as they essentially want to say 9/11 is the day liberty died. 9/11, the day liberty died. A three-judge panel on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled unanimously Friday that protesters may not be required to pass through metal detectors when they gather next month for a rally against the U.S. Training Academy for Latin American Soldiers. We simply cannot, said Judge Gerald Chovlat, We simply cannot suspend or restrict civil liberties until the war on terror is over, because the war on terror is unlikely ever to be truly over. September 11th, already a day of immeasurable tragedy, cannot be the day liberty perished in this country. See, what they wanted to do, these people were showing up outside a military base, on public property, outside the base, to just hold up signs and things. And they wanted to say, no, before you can do that, you have to pass through metal detectors, you have to be vetted, you have to, you know, be essentially intimidated. And the federal appeals court said, nope, sorry, guys. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tom in Nashville, Tennessee is on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. I heard you talking about the Bill O'Reilly interview, and I want to say I heard both of those interviews with her. I heard the one with Bill O'Reilly, and I also heard the one with Al Franken.
Mm-hmm.
And you took just a little clip out of that O'Reilly interview that wasn't actual. It didn't really come across as the way the interview did.
Yeah, I took the bully part out of it. I mean, he had a rational conversation with her for much of the interview.
Well, she really railed on him pretty hard, and she had gotten him on the interview to discuss the book. Mm-hmm. She never really talked about the book. Mm-hmm. And he was getting kind of ticked off about it because he thought it was all going to be about the book.
Yeah, but have you...
She took him to task over things that Al Franken was saying in his book.
Yeah, I understand, Tom, but do you listen to Fresh Air very often?
Not really.
Okay.
Once in a while.
You know, I listen to it fairly regularly. I used to listen to it every day because it was during a time when I was driving, and that's what Terry Gross usually does. She will discuss the topic of a book from time to time, but really, I mean, you know, anybody can talk about the topic of the book. What she's trying to do is introduce the author to her listeners. She's trying to make the author a person, a human being, and I mean, you know, tune her in today. You'll get it that what she's about is more, I mean, I don't mean this in a denigrating way, but it's more kind of Oprah journalism. It's the personal touch. It's like, who is this person anyway who is writing this book? What kind of bias are they bringing to the book? What's their worldview? What's their perspective? How should we look at the book through their eyes? How do their eyes view the world?
Yeah, but after listening to both of those interviews, I have to say that she really came down pretty hard on Bill O'Reilly, and she just gave Al Franken a pass.
Yeah, okay.
And
well,
it was very obvious and very blatant.
Let's say that's the case. Do you think, nonetheless, do you think that a bullying approach got O'Reilly what he wanted?
Oh, no, I disagree. I don't think that was called for. I think he went a little over the top, which he's prone to do, and which is probably why he gets a lot of ratings.
Yeah, exactly, and that's my point.
I mean, it's just his style, and you got to understand that.
Sure, and it's all theater, and the guy's a bully, and he's a bully on the air. And in fact, you know, I frankly debated with myself whether or not I should even play it, because talking about it gives you more publicity, and that's what he wants.
To put the thing in context, you got to play both interviews, I believe, to really hear the difference in the tone of the interview and the questions and the way she came across, because it was night and day.
Well, I agree if I was doing a show about Terry Gross.
Right.
But I wasn't. I was talking about Bill O'Reilly.
But I also want to talk to you about one other thing.
Sure.
I don't understand why the liberals have to turn this into such a personal political discussion. They want to, you included, want to make President Bush look like it's all a big sinister conspiracy by the right wing, and he's evil and hateful and all this stuff.
Conspiracy to do what?
Oh, you can't talk to a liberal about politics without conspiracies entering into the conversation. It's all about Halliburton and oil and big business and put money in his pocket. And nobody ever really thinks that maybe he's just a good, decent, honest guy doing what he thinks is best for the country, and so is Kerry. I think they're both that way. I think they're both trying to do what they think is right. And I don't think that it's right that liberals try to turn this into a hatred, personal thing.
You know, Tom, I agree with you. To some extent.
It really bothers me a lot.
And I have to say, and I've said it many times on this program, I believe that George Bush believes that he's doing the right thing. I also believe he's deluded. I think, you know, the fact that he's unwilling to listen to advice, the fact that he's unwilling to tolerate anybody who dissents from him, that anybody who disagrees with him publicly gets fired. People who disagree with him publicly get not just fired but punished, as in the case of Joe Wilson.
None of that's true. See, it's going back to the old hatred.
He didn't fire Lawrence Lindsay, his financial advisor, when he came out and he said, you know, you're going to have a huge budget deficit. He didn't fire General Shinseki after he said, you know, you're going to need more.
No, he did not fire General Shinseki. That guy was...
That's right. He was going to be
retirement months before that.
Yeah, you're right. He was going to be retired, but
he was. And yeah. So to say that he fired him is just a blatant distortion. And Kerry keeps promoting it, and so do you and all the rest of people.
Let's say he didn't fire him. He removed him from participating in what he was doing.
He was
several
on a
months
fast track to retirement.
But he removed him from that role that he had months earlier than he would have been removed from it by virtue of his retirement because of what he said.
Oh, that's not true.
Well, sure it is. I mean, that's the basis of what you accurately describe as the distortion that he was fired. He was taken out of that loop.
Well, why have a guy in there that you know is retiring that
you disagree
with the way you want to run things when you've got all your other generals lined up behind you and saying something different?
Yeah, well, see, you're making my point that Bush really only wants yes men around him. And I think that that's a real dangerous thing. A lot of presidents, most presidents through history, have preferred to hear both sides of the view. I mean,
well, when you're engaged in something as dangerous and as trying as this is, you need to have a bunch of good people around you that really want to be on your team, that really want to back you up and do what you want.
I think when you're engaged in something that involves life and death, war and peace, it's even more important to have people involved who dissent. So that you're hearing both points.
I think he's getting some good advice from his generals.
I don't believe it. And the proof of it is what's going on in Iraq right now.
Well, look at Colin Powell. He dissented for a long time, right up until the edge of the war. And then he finally agreed to it, and he wasn't fired. He wasn't marginalized.
He was tremendously marginalized.
Oh, he was not. He was out there stumping. He was making speeches. He was talking to all these heads of state all the way through it.
Yeah, I would encourage you to read Bob Woodward's book. I mean, it's
well, I'd encourage you to go out and rent Fahrenheit 9/11, HYPE,
uh-huh.
And it really dispels a lot of the myths and inaccuracies that Michael Moore put out there.
I see. Okay. Tom, right. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
All right. Thank you.
1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Let's see. Art in California is on the line. Hey, Art, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm just calling in concerning the caller that called in from Florida about the problem they were having with voting machines down there.
Uh-huh.
And here in the Banana Republic of Riverside, we use the same voting machines, which are Sequoia. It took some quick research on the Internet to find out which machines they used.
Mm-hmm.
If the machine that they had a problem with was used in test mode, the votes are still there because that's the mode they run logic and accuracy tests on. I just went through with one here in the Banana Republic, and they count the votes off the cartridges from the test machines.
Uh-huh.
So those votes are still there, and if the registrar or the actually he's a supervisor of elections in Hillsborough County, if he's claiming that those votes are lost, it's a fabrication because they're not.
Well, that's interesting. You might want to call the supervisor of elections in Hillsborough County.
I might just do that.
Or you know, actually, whoever was our listener who called in, who was it who called from Florida? That was Kevin from Florida. Hey, Kevin, you should go back down to that district where you were voting and tell them what Art just shared with us. Interesting information. I learned so much from my listeners. Art, thanks for the call.
You're welcome, Tom.
Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, Transforming the World by Revitalizing Democracy.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. In vacuums, bagless is a dirty word. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums. And if you own one, they advise you to wear a dust mask. I would never put the Oric name on a bagless vacuum. They're filthy. My hypoallergenic Oric XL uses triple-walled, disposable filter bags. They hold four times more than the leading brand of bagless vacuums. What goes in the Oric bag stays in the bag, including bacteria and viruses. Empty a bagless vacuum, and the dust goes right back into the room you've just cleaned. Is this sanitary? Oric cleans the air as it vacuums the floor. Try my 8-pound Oric XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200. It's the clean alternative to bagless vacuums.
A researcher has suggestions for homeowners to keep birds flying instead of dying. I'm Richard Hooks for Earthwatch Radio. Birds routinely fly into glass windows simply because they don't see them. They might see reflections of the sky or something behind the glass that they want to investigate. What they don't see is a physical barrier that can hurt them and even kill them. Daniel Clem is a biologist with Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania. He's spent decades studying the problems birds have with glass windows. Clem estimates that in the United States, at least 100 million birds die each year from hitting glass.
Short of habitat destruction, glass is the greatest source of death for wild birds, among them the rare, endangered, and threatened species of the world.
Clem has tried to find ways to reduce these fatal encounters. He says it helps to cover windows with nets or awnings during times of heavy bird activity. It also helps to adjust the position of bird feeders near windows. If they're close to the glass, a bird that accidentally flies from a feeder into a window pane won't be moving fast enough to get hurt. And Clem says birds will recognize the glass barrier if decals or other stickers are attached to the outside of windows.
If you take hawk silhouettes, or it doesn't matter, whatever shape, it could be diamonds, it could be circles, it could be anything, and you uniformly cover the surface of the glass, you have increased the opportunity of those animals to be able to recognize the glass as a barrier and stay away from it. If you're willing to do this, then the more that you can tolerate under your window, the better it will be for protecting the birds.
Clem says a long-term solution would be an entirely new kind of glass. He envisions something that's transparent from the inside, but appears to have patterns in it when viewed from the outside. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Here they come again. Can't you sit again?
Oh, is this the song for John Ashcroft or for? Let's not even go there. 5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Gene from Hillsboro, Oregon on the line. Or Oregon, excuse me. Hey, Gene, welcome. Welcome.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
I just called about your last caller, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just His comment about the left is always doing this conspiracy thing. I watched, this David Horowitz guy on C-SPAN last night. He was this author of Unholy Alliance with the alliance between Islam and the American left or whatever. And it's like, talk about conspiracies.
Oh, yeah. You know, the right is right. I mean, the biggest conspiracy theory out there and the most widely accepted is the conspiracy theory that the media is liberal.
Yeah,
and it's a conspiracy on the right.
I couldn't take that because it's like I've been watching this thing develop since the Bush administration started, and it's like for the last two or three years or even longer they've had nothing but conspiracy theories and books on conspiracies and all this jazz, and now we're at this point. It's enough to.
There are conspiracy theories on the left, and some of them are pretty loony. And there are conspiracy theories on the right, and some of them are pretty loony. And it's just, it's a welcome to the wonderful world of human nature. I think we really need to be talking more about the issues. Gene, I thanks for pointing that out. I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. Roy in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Roy, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, I don't like to get things personal either, but I wish that other caller had been talking about how personal the slime boat liars got when they attacked Kerry's heroism, so then they could attack his patriotism.
Yeah.
And I took it very personally when the Secret Service would not let me access public domain property to walk over to go appear at a rally that my tax dollars was paying for.
Yeah.
You know, I take things like that personally. I take it very personally.
We take democracy seriously.
I really take it personally, Tom. Yeah. And I take it seriously.
I agree, Joe.
I'm going to do my job carrying a landslide.
Yeah, there you go. Carrying a landslide. From your lips to God's ears. I take democracy personally, too, Roy. And we have to do something to take it back. Left, right, in between, this transcends liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, green, progressive. We must take democracy back in a civilized fashion. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today, to Rama Schneider for engineering it, to Brad Walrod for our music, to Shelby LaPree for streaming us around the planet, Ben Birch for our archives at White Rose Society, which I understand are going to be back up and intact soon. To our sponsors, the folks in our chat room, to Jay for our music, and to you. Thanks. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.